across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Take a trip into the alternate reality of Late Night Radio.
I think I'm in something like The Matrix, and so are you.
Speech Radio, give a difference.
Is there anybody out there?
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Hello, friends. Yes, it's me, Rufus. I mean, I don't know what normal service is anymore, or whether it will be resumed at any point in the near future. I literally got a phone call, I think, as I was eating a sandwich, asking me if I could be here. And the God's honest truth, dear listener, is that I can't. There is absolutely no reason on God's good earth why I should be here now. I'm currently working incredibly hard trying to get a play together for the Chichester Festival, where I have more words than exist in the dictionary to learn in the right order with the correct dramatic intention. And yet, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. What is it, do you think? What is the magnet that draws me, a simple iron filing, back to the polarity of talk radio? Well, I will tell you, friends. It's Sammy, the man on the phones. It's Kath, the woman sat to my right.
That's me.
And it's you, the caller slash listener. That trilogy, that triumvirate, is a pull too strong. You are a cyclone. I simply a small kraken drawn inexorably into the vortex.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
I suppose I'm just a boy stood in front of a girl saying, welcome to the Late Night Alternative on talkradio.co.uk. University for cheap people. Talk Radio will get you talking. We'll also get you listening, but they don't mention that on the poster, do they?
And according to Twitter, we'll get you swearing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well. Look, it's the Late Night Alternative. If you're listening for the first time, frankly, seems unlikely, but you might be, then you might be thinking, well, hang on a sec. Hold up there. Grab the reins. Pull back. Stop that horse. Talk, 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 talk. Is that all this is? No. No, it's a little listen. It's a little talk. It's a little bit me. It's a little bit you. It's a little bit country. It's a little bit rock and roll. In other words, it's a two-way stream, and I, the island in it. This evening I will be your Kenny Rogers. Kath, will you do me the honour of dollying up?
I surely will.
How do you get involved? You pick up your telephone. The number to call is 0344 499 1000. Alternatively, on Twitter, we are at Talk Radio, or indeed, on a text message, you start the message with the word talk and you send it to 87222. Messages cost 25 pence plus your standard network rate. Also, now I'm seeing that there's a Facebook thing we can give out, which is facebook.com/talkradiouk. I don't know if you've been following the news. Facebook might not be something you want to be on massively at the moment, sharing things about yourself, what you like, what you don't like, or the radio stations you listen to. But maybe you do. Maybe you don't care about that kind of thing. So facebook.com/talkradiouk.
And I can say that we are using it to manipulate your mind. So
we absolutely are.
Yeah.
We are using it to initially influence your mind, latterly your hands, and finally your trousers.
Oh!
That's how it works, Kath. That's the end game here. Don't pretend like you don't know this. That's what Russia wants. If we're all busy playing with ourselves, we won't spot them creeping in the back door with the big Russian files and their totalitarian regime disguised as a democracy. We won't spot them, Kath, if we're all fapping away.
Flipping it.
Like wet flip-flops in front of a Dyson Airblade. Other Airblades are available.
But they're not as good.
They're not as good. We all know that by now. If you need blowy air things, it's a Dyson you want. And we can all pretend otherwise.
Although I can't work out that hairdryer.
You can't. What do you mean you can't work
well,
it out?
£200 for a hairdryer.
Oh no, sure. The economics of it are you know, to be questioned. But I think sitting there saying you can't work out a hairdryer, it's not a particle accelerator, is it?
But it looks like a ring, doesn't it, on a stick?
It does.
Yeah.
But it works the same way as those. Yeah, the flat fans. Well, it's just clever vortexy stuff that they've worked out. It's all very good.
You've got nice hair. Do you use one of those? Are you standard?
Very, very kind of you to say. Weirdly, the play that I'm in at the moment, I'm playing a 40-year-old man who is midlife crisis, and there's plenty of references made to his thinning hair.
Oh.
And I had a meeting with the wigs department the other day, and they just went, "Yeah, well, I think we can kind of leave everything as it is."
Oh, ouch!
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't deny them the veracity, but at the same time, I can't pretend not to have been a little stung by it. Yeah. But you know, my dad was bald when he was 28. I've made it this far. That's always been the one thing that my mum has drilled into me is, I mean, you will lose your hair, son, but you're already older than 28, so
you're kind of winning.
You've got a few more runs in the scoreboard, on the follicular scoreboard, than your old man managed. You know, you take what you can get.
You're making up for it, like, facially.
Oh, facially. But isn't that...
You can't stop that, can you?
Well, it seems to be what happens. Just as the hair right on the top started getting thinner and thinner and thinner, I've got hairs growing out the top of my nose, top of my ears, inside my ears. Any minute now, I'm expecting David Bellamy to leap out with a revelation.
It's like someone pushed your Play-Doh down.
Don't push my Play-Doh down. Nashville, get in touch. Oh, up the nose, in the ears, on the top of the ears, on the top of the nose. It's now just a Brillo pad trying to scream its way out of my head face. Oh, it's awful. Awful.
I like it. I think it's it's very hairy.
Can I congratulate you via the listener for trying to make that a positive? I like it. She said, picking at her nails. I think it was really nice.
It's different. Every time I see you, you do something different with your face.
Oh, I like to zhuzh it up, you know. It's like providing a moving target, isn't it? If you always look a little bit different, then people won't know which letterbox to put the dog poo in. That's my theory. And so far, on my flip around wall chart, I am 300 days letterbox dog poo free. So bite me, logic. Well, look, we can talk about dog poo in letterboxes all night, and in many ways, possibly we should. But it's the late-night alternative. The agenda here is not set by us, it's set by you. So you pick up the telephone, you dial 0344-499-1000, and you get involved. Before then, though, a quick confession, and that is this. I almost sort of didn't make it tonight. I agreed to do the job. I was doing not just the rehearsals of the play, another job after that, and then coming here. There was some administrative foolishness at my end, meaning that I literally just walked out of a room and went, "I really have to go now." And so I have literally, all I have said to Kath is, "Are we on yet?" And then run into this room.
No, you did say you needed a wee.
Well, I did say I needed a wee. I was going to spare them. I thought the dog poo through the letterbox. We had enough downstairs chat.
You misjudged your audience.
You'd think I'd have learnt by now. Ah, oh, a lovely wee. Hey, look, I'll go one step further. It wasn't just a wee I had.
Oh, man, I thought you were a long time.
Yeah. And what makes it worse is I've got quite a slow bowel. I don't know. That hasn't really changed as I've got older, necessarily. That's been true, I'm going to say, knocking on 20 years. people who can get that job done quickly astound me. That's something where your body is going to do a thing, and the speed that your body does that thing seems to me to be set. That's not something you apply yourself to. That's not a task. It feels to me you can speed up. Anyway, I did my level best, and then I was drying my hands and I walked in. And Kath went, what are you drying your hands at? I just washed my hands. I was sort of trying to be gentlemanly.
So it's good to know.
Always good to know. So you'll be pleased to know I am an empty vessel ready to receive anything that you, the talk radio listener, feels they want to offer. But before then, how the dickens are you, Kath?
Rubbish.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm having a really horrible time.
Why?
Just stuff is happening and I don't like it.
I have advised you previously, haven't I, to buy yourself a Kath-sized box, plenty of good cotton wool, some protein bars, and one of those eye masks that you get on an aeroplane.
Yeah.
But you will not listen to me, Kath. You insist on being a modern woman out in the real world, applying yourself, and it's all going wrong. And I told you this would happen.
Things keep happening. So my youngest badly executed a dance move yesterday in the living room in the morning when I wasn't present. Her father was on duty.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I'm... Since I don't know if you picked that up audio-wise, but there was definitely a frisson there.
If
that wasn't a breadstick snapping in the back... Breadstick snapping in the background you heard.
No, it was my daughter's wrist.
Oh!
Didn't quite snap, but she hurt it, and she was going on, you know the way they do, going on.
On and on.
She nearly didn't go to the bowling party.
Oh, Jesus Lord. Oh, no.
She really wanted the pizza that was involved. So they went, but she came home early because she missed Mummy and her hand was sore. And I said, right, enough of this nonsense. Let's take you to hospital. I don't want to go to hospital. I don't want to go to hospital. She went to hospital. And, yeah, she's got like a hairline fracture.
Oh, and went bowling with a hairline fracture.
They used the ramps. Well, they're not animals.
Oh.
And it was the left hand, which she doesn't normally use. But it's always that kid. I've got one kid who is, you know, like I've got off the shelf in mother care, and another one that is severely defective.
Is it the older one or the younger
one?
The
younger one. She's an absolute beast. If there's something to throw herself off or land awkwardly on, she'll find it.
Oh, God love her. I've got a sort of respect for that gung-ho attitude.
She's an idiot like me. It's always showing off as well. Like the same injuries that I had when I was a kid. I broke my arm twice, once trying to ice skate, showing off. The second, standing on my friend's shoulders, being an acrobat, showing off. you know, the things that have happened to me, I used to throw myself off the stairs thinking that my wings would grow. It was just a terrible time for my parents. Yeah.
I'm glad you kept the receipt for those sanitary towels.
And the kid does the same thing. I told her the wings story and she tried it herself.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. A little bit of moral guidance here. Like, yes, well, we've all been silly at one time or another, darling. I was so stupid I once tried that. Internal child logic. Hang on a sec. She might just have been doing it wrong. There's only one way I can prove this is a double-blind test. Mum's always telling me about science. Wait till her back's turned.
You've met her then. So, yeah, and then there's the other one who's just far too sensible, doesn't try any of that nonsense, never smeared makeup all over the sofas, like the second one. Mm. You know, if I'd have had the second one first, there wouldn't have been a second one.
Right, yeah, weird that.
The first one was like your training baby. This one's like standard... And no, uncomplicated, and you won't really have to do an awful lot with her, apart from sometimes deny her visits to the rabbits at Pets at Home.
Right.
If she misbehaves.
Yeah.
Second one, nightmare. The second, although hilarious, they nature does balance it out.
Yeah.
Like, for example, when she was about 1.5, sitting in the trolley at Tesco's, she kicked off.
Right. Just went for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, blue face. My technique has always been... low and menacing.
Oh, hello. You put a slight jitter through me, didn't you?
And I said, we do not do this. You carry on. We're putting all this shopping back and we will be leaving. Now, say sorry to all these nice people. And this kid in the front of the trolley, sorry about that, everyone. Sorry.
Guys, gather around, guys. Just a few words. Sorry, won't take a sec. Gather in.
Like, yeah. I don't know what came over me. I lost it there for a minute, guys. But it was just everyone in the queue trying not to laugh because she was so, I'm sorry about that, everyone. I'm sorry.
Wow. Yeah. But I've got two children and I think they just find a niche. I think that whatever the first one's bringing to the party, the second one's like, well, that's their thing.
Yes.
I better jazz something up here. My eldest is a boy, so, you know, I read those, you know, Raising Boys, Raising Girl books that, on the one hand, now that we live in a kind of ideally post-gender society, you would think, oh, there's no difference at all. But this made the case that there rather was, and that boys will respond best to just direct instructions. Sit! Roll over! Play dead! And, all right, yeah. And that seems to work for the boy.
Well, it's a bit more psychological with girls, is it?
Oh, mate.
We do not do this.
Yeah. With my daughter, I was like, well, look, until she's a bit older, you know, there really isn't going to be any difference, so I'll just treat them exactly the same. Literally by three. Sit. Why? What do you mean? Because you're three and you have no concept of the dangers around you and it's dinner time and that's basic human etiquette? I mean, what do I need to explain here? You just sit. Well, don't want to. I'm busy.
Busy. And she was.
Yeah. In fairness to her, that was a lovely macaroni picture of half a cat. Yeah, it's everything's a negotiation. Everything is like you got to frame it up right, and the emotionality as well is staggering. My wife went out for literally 20 minutes last night, and my daughter threw, like, we went away for 10 days. Right, it's a chilly, and then got back and made like a big fuss of them, and then having been back, she's just been sort of a lot more clingy, and so yeah, Beth was going out for 20 minutes, half an hour maybe.
End of the world, was it?
And you know, had all been put to bed. Beth had bathed her and everything in bed, and then I just hear from upstairs. I love you! I miss you! Chill the F out! Keep playing it!
Just go around the corner!
These are the noises made by somebody with a genuine distress. We have people, neighbours phoning Childline for my wife going for a, you know, brandy and lemon. Absolutely unfathomable.
Yeah. I've got two of those.
So that's not been very good.
No.
And other things.
And there are other things afoot.
Other things.
Like, well, I'm going to say, my grandma's very ill. And so it's that, you know. So, and she's a long way away. And so there have been a few sort of mercy dashes. And it's not looking, you know, it's very bleak.
Mm, that's a shame.
Yeah, so it's all that sort of stuff, you know. Actually, comedy pirouette injury yesterday was a bit of light relief.
I know what I need to take my mind off the inevitability of life's end. You, child, dance for mummy.
Don't. I'm already probably on some sort of list at that hospital because she's in there every 5 weeks.
There's a thin line, isn't there, between needing to be genuinely alarmed as a medical professional and just accepting, oh, it's one of those. This poor woman's given birth to one of those.
Yes. A kid that thinks she can bounce better than she can.
If you wonder what I mean by a one of those, you'll almost certainly find out as we talk to the listeners, which we will do after these commercial messages.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
You join me halfway through a tweet. If you've just received half a tweet from me, it's because I panicked and hit send. One man who in many ways is permanently halfway through a tweet is our first caller this evening. Can you guess who it is? It's Alan Caddick, reigning champion! AC, how the deuce are you?
Not bad. I've got my first question. Where's the governor?
I don't know. Next question.
Have you got an idea, Kath, where the governor is?
Yes. None of your business.
Ah, parry, touche. And your second question, Alan?
I've just been... been checking out Dollar Boingo's 8-bit on Dave.
Yeah.
And they've got John Thompson playing Wolfenstein 3D.
Right.
I've never heard of that game before.
Wolfenstein 3D?
I've never heard of that one.
Well, I think I'm right in... let me, very quickly, for anybody who doesn't give a hoot about video games, let me say Darrow Breen Goes 8-Bit is a show on Dave in which Darrow Breen and a couple of young fellas who actually started a version of this show in Edinburgh are joined by slightly more well-known faces to compete in a series of challenges that are basically playing either new or vintage video games. Wolfenstein 3D, I think I'm right in saying, was the first 3D first-person shooter, i.e. you were walking around in 3D space and were shooting. I think it's... Wolfenstein, I think, is like Nazis and then demons.
Hang on, it is just Nazis.
Because I think Doom was the demons, but basically Doom did what Wolfenstein 3D did better than Wolfenstein. So everybody thinks that Doom was the first of those games, but actually it was Wolfenstein 3D.
Yeah, because they were shooting Hitler.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, shooting Nazis, basically, in about 1993?
Yeah, because the boss was a cyber Hitler.
Yeah, that would make sense. So, yeah, anyway, if you've not heard of that game, that's what it is.
Another guy classic.
What are they playing now, Alan?
Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah. Do you know, I was reading a thing the other day that said everybody goes on about what a classic Sonic the Hedgehog was, but there's a huge number of people who played that game once and went, this is rubbish. And they partly did that because in the olden days, it was the battle of were you Nintendo or were you Sega?
It was Sonic versus Mario.
Oh, it's the new one on the... Is it on the Switch? Or, actually, when they filmed that, it might still have been the Wii U?
No, but that battle you were talking about in 1991, you had a Nintendo console with Mario, or you had a Sega Mega Drive, and it was Sonic.
Oh, I see what you mean. You see, there is now a game called Mario vs. Sonic, so I thought that's what you were talking about. But yes, in the olden days, it was you were either a Mario person or a Sonic person. And my God, if you cut me, I still bleed Italian plumber.
So do I.
Yeah.
My first console was a Super Nintendo, so I was pro Mario.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Only a low-level scumbag would be into Sega, and I say that unabashedly. a quick note for the listener. I realise this would possibly work better on television, but our operator Sam, who's the other side of the glass, is pointing himself saying very much a child of Sega.
I thought Sam had proper tape, but obviously yeah. I was wrong.
It changes everything once you know this about a person, doesn't it, Alan?
Yeah, but, I mean, what was your favourite Mario game?
Well, I mean, I'm still very much a Mario Kart sort of chap, but what was it called? Mario Galaxy on the Wii, I think, is probably my favourite video game of all time. However, I just bought a Nintendo Switch, and having played... Oh, God, this is where my brain's going to go absolutely on the fritz. Odyssey. Mario Odyssey. I couldn't tell you I've ever played a better video game than that either. So I just think it's... Since the GameCube era, where they went for... Was it GameCube or was it the N64?
Oh, the N64.
The N64, where they did Mario 3D, 64. Yeah, three dimensions. It was, I think they really worked out how to smash that with Galaxy and Odyssey. Odyssey has got so many mini-games in it, and the mini-games in Odyssey on any other video game would be like the whole point of playing the game.
With me, mob for the classic Marios, with me it had to be Super Mario 3.
Say that again.
My favourite Mario game was Super Mario 3.
Oh, right, yeah, Super Mario Brothers 3. On the SNES?
No, the original NES.
Oh, was it on the NES?
It was first released on the NES, and it was re-released on the SNES as part of Super Mario All-Stars.
Oh, yeah, that does ring a bell. Yeah, look, my mum, for my birthday, just bought me... Have you seen those mini NESs?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
My mum bought me one for my birthday, and I've been playing Dr. Mario, and the thing I've learnt or relearnt about video games from the late 80s is that they're all jackhard! They are so tough. There's not save points, there's not like, oh, well, I'll put that down and come back to it later. There is, close the door, you know, turn off your phone, you are going to be staring at this screen incessantly for the next 3 to 4 hours if you're going to get through this.
You're the reason your mother would stand at the bottom of the stairs and go, just one more level, just yeah. one more level.
It's a bit like when they released Tetris from a Nintendo Game Boy.
Oh, don't talk to me about Tetris. I played Tetris so much that when I closed my eyes, all I could see were lines shooting down and disappearing, and my brain formulating different ways to spin things that would fit together.
I actually do think that game made us a bit cleverer.
Really?
Yeah.
Increased our spatial awareness, possibly.
How would you make it more clever, Kath?
No, I mean, that your brain, it was kind of brain training, wasn't it? Because you were planning ahead, you were seeing the shapes, you were seeing where they were supposed to go. I actually think that made me a bit quicker.
And I've actually applied that into real life.
Yeah, well.
When filling the freezer, I would place things in a Tetris style formation to make it all fit.
Oh, yeah, my pan cupboard's like Jenga. It's that moment where you go, right, that one, if someone moves out, it's all going to go, but I'll just shut the door.
I tell you what, my Twitter's just exploded with people saying, where's it gone? Hang on. And we Amiga owners look down on you and the Nintendo. Look down on you, Nintendo and Sega kids. Wasn't that always the way?
And computers don't count.
Computers don't count. We know that. And also, you know, the PC Master Race, all that old business about, oh, you haven't really played the games, you played it on PC. Naff off.
MS-1.
Naff off.
You need it.
They are toys. Bring me a thing. Let me smack it into a thing. Press a button and go. If I've got to, you know, do a degree in computer engineering before I can get the exact right number of frames per second at the right hertz rate, you're doing it wrong! You are taking it too seriously! Stop it!
They started all this with a ZX Spectrum.
Oh.
Yeah.
I had one of those. Beautiful.
Well, that was just track and field, wasn't it? The ZX Spectrum.
Where... Saboteur. Oh. And Outrun.
Oh, Outrun.
Yeah.
Yeah, all
and
right.
And if you wanted the music, you just had to turn the tape over and press play.
Yeah, that for hours and hours, no.
For me, it was a Grand National game.
Of course it was.
I think we're beginning to see the origin story here of Alan Caddick. What was in the Grand National game?
It was basically mixed up horses where you had to bet on the horse and you could actually control the horse and actually ride in the Grand National itself.
Mm.
Was it a two-button thing where you had to...
Of course it was.
Well, you had to use a joystick.
Yeah, that's a fence.
You had a joystick to control it.
Oh, fence. You had a joystick, wow.
Show off.
Hey, needy.
Well, look, Alan, next time I see Dara, I'll send him your details.
Yeah?
See if we can get you on there.
Yeah?
Playing the Amiga Grand National game.
No, the ZX Spectrum.
Oh, ZX, apologies. Oh,
well, that could have been a calamity, couldn't it?
Very awkward conversation.
And also, for home computers, the Spectrum's better than the Amstrad.
Hello! Shots fired!
Hashtag scenes.
Other than that, Alan, apart from watching Dara O'Brien, are you alright?
Yeah, that man. I'm getting ready for my holiday in a couple of weeks' time, but I will be back on Monday night to give a full report.
Going anywhere nice?
I'll be going to Blackpool and then to Aintree.
So, no.
Tell me you again, Cav. It's Grand National time!
So do you save up for Aintree?
Yes, I do.
And then do you come out of there up or down, largely?
Oh, my break even. I mean, 2 years ago, Cav had a shock when she saw me in the paper.
Really?
We all had a shock when he saw me in the paper. Yeah. He was riding...
he was leaping majestically over Beecher's Brook.
He was riding a wooden horse, rather frantically.
Wow.
And I've still got another photographer who had the paper, badly sent me a hard copy of that picture.
I bet he did.
Yeah. Well, he's.
And my dad had copies done and handed them out. One, next thing I know, one copy of me is on a dartboard.
Oh. Yeah, quite a hard upbringing, I would imagine. So, how long have you been in Blackpool for?
I'll be travelling up on Friday the 13th.
Uh-oh.
Coming home on Monday the 16th.
Right. And when's entry?
The 14th.
Right, got you. Oh, that'll be a lovely little time away, a little jolly holiday.
And I will be seeing Robert Caff.
Oh.
My brother, who lives in Blackpool.
You won't be seeing him?
No, I will be.
Oh, you will, good.
Otherwise, he hadn't called in to speak to Rufus.
Well, that sounds like a call.
Yeah.
That sounds like a clarion call.
Oh, it's a jolly holiday with Caddick. Caddick makes the sunshine bright.
Well, it's been a while since he spoke to Ian.
Yeah, this is true.
But, you know, time stretches on. New opportunities present themselves every corner.
Breaking news. I've just seen a trailer for a good film on Friday. Isle of Dogs.
Oh.
Yeah. That's had a bit of contention surrounding it, but I've got a feeling it's been taken the wrong way.
Mm. My daughters aren't aware of that whole furore.
Yeah.
They do know that when we saw the trailer for it at the cinema, they said, that looks creepy, we don't want to see it. I burned them with Coraline, you see.
Ah.
Creepy films.
Creepy film, creepy animated film.
Yeah.
Have they seen Fantastic Mr. Fox?
Yeah, they found that a little bit creepy too.
Yeah, right. Because everything's used to being so sort of clean and tiny and Pixar-y and CG.
It's all a bit itchy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit itchy. It's got a texture to it,
mm-hmm.
which I rather like. Having grown up on Bertha and Postman Pat and the like.
Tell you what they did enjoy this weekend. The Princess Bride.
Oh!
It was a huge hit!
Oh my gosh.
I've never seen that film.
Oh!
Make it so.
Caddick, you absolute chief. What are you playing at? What are you doing phoning talk radio night after night after night when you could have been utilising that time to watch Princess Bride 5,000 times?
Because I was watching Space Camp.
Not good enough. Not good enough. Princess Bride, mate, get it in your face. Peter Falk as the granddad. Fred Savage as the grandchild. The grandchild is ill. How's he going to while away his hours? Well, granddad's going to read him a story. Oh, granddad, not a boring story. Ah, sit down, kid. Lie back. I used to read this to your dad, I think, when he was a kid.
Yes.
Like, oh, all right, fine. And then we find out about Buttercup and Wesley and the dread pirate Roberts in a tale of swashbuckling derring do.
The moment I knew that my girls were hooked was when he interrupts it the first time and says, oh, there's a kissing book. Because they were just saying the same thing.
Oh, it's one of the finest pieces of storytelling ever committed to celluloid, Caddick.
Get on it, Caddick. Get on it hard.
Get on it.
I'll have to go on my Cody Fire Stick and see if I can watch it on a build.
We can't condone such illegal activity, but we know it happens.
Yeah. We'll turn a blind eye this once just so you can fill this, let me be honest, gaping chasm in your life.
But I wouldn't put it on Facebook, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the new Facebook page yet.
You haven't seen the new Facebook page yet?
It's the old Facebook page.
With a different strap line underneath where it says Talk Radio. They put it on the screen in the studio.
I was going to say, if anyone wants to join on Facebook, then my page, Ian Lee on Talk Radio, or with Talk Radio Listeners, or Talk Radio Rebels.
Oh, is there a page Talk Radio Rebels?
Yeah, you have choices. There's all kinds of sects.
For people who find the mainstream Talk Radio Facebook page too anodyne.
It's like the Judean People's Front. People's Front of Judea.
Well, splitters. well, look, Cads, we cannot stress strongly enough, you need to get The Princess Bride watched.
I'm on it.
Billy Crystal's in it. Carol King's in it. Mel
Columbo.
Smith's in it. Christopher Guest is in it.
Columbo.
Peter Falk, yeah, he was the granddad.
All the hits.
Oh, man, it's just like a who's who. Andre the Giant's in it. Mandy Patinkin's
in it. Andre the Giant! I didn't think he would do that after WrestleMania 3.
Oh, mate, Andre the Giant in that film establishes himself as an icon for all times.
Yeah, and they had to get him to learn the script phonetically because they couldn't understand him when he was reading it from the script.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, Christ, what do you not want to know about Andre the Giant?
That's wonderful.
I know Hulk Hogan body slammed him at WrestleMania 3.
Well, that's true, yeah.
And it was an impossible thing to do at the time.
impossible in wrestling terms. I mean, you know,
Andre the Giant must have been about £500, wasn't he?
I think 600. Yeah, 600 plus.
He was a large unit.
He was a big boy.
Can you imagine if Andre the Giant was alive today? Can you imagine him and a big set in the ring? They'll probably destroy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but there's been a sort of history ever since the days of Andre the Giant to find those, you know, enormous men and bring them to the ring, and none of them have ever been a patch on Andre the Giant. There was, even though he looked kind of vaguely monstrous, you could tell from the eyes there was a truly beautiful man lurking under there. And when you read a little bit about Andre the Giant's life, I mean, tragic. He lived his life in constant pain because, you know, his condition was such that he was just too big, you know, everything hurt. So he used to, like, drink cases of beer daily. That was just, like, you know, how to numb it all off and all sorts. And, you know, his time on Princess Bride was, you know, kind of towards the end. I think he died after filming and before it was released. It was like, you know, it was that tight. But, my gosh, that man, that part, absolute heaven. So, Cads, get it watched, and maybe the next time I'm here, we can have a little discussion about the Princess Bride. Sound good to you?
I'm on it.
Get on it.
Late Night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
This is a Late Night Alternative. You're listening to Talk Radio. My name's Rufus, and this is my friend Kath.
Yeah.
Woo! We're the cool kids.
Well.
We're leaning against the school, wearing sunglasses, eating candy cigarettes, and exhaling warmly into cold air to make it look like smoke. All right. Being the late-night alternative, what we talk about is entirely decided by you. It is done democratically. 03444991000 is the number you call. We talk about whatever you want to talk about. You know, we were talking about Andre the Giant before.
Mm-hmm.
If only there was some link to our next caller.
If only.
Andre! How are you?
Oh, mate.
Yeah, you!
Hi, Wolfus, my old friend. It's David Bower, me, actually.
It's who?
David Bower, mate.
David Birra?
David Bower, mate.
David Bellamy, sorry.
Yes, that's yes. Me.
Emerging this from my ear.
Yeah, I've been doing a bit of gardening today, Rufus, yeah, actually. And there's a funny story behind it.
Is
because there? What happened, I've got some compost.
Yeah.
Mixed up with watted manure, yeah.
Yeah, watted, yeah.
Right, which my mum gave me. Right, now what happened? She said, that's brilliant for roses, yeah?
Yeah.
So I was out there, I made a nice, like, sort of, you know, boulder ready to plant a few of these roses into that.
Yeah.
I've dug the hole, put the stuff in it, put my rose in, first rose, put the stuff around it.
Yeah.
I thought, lovely, that's really wonderful. And then I went to the next one, potted it, dug the hole with the trowel, put in the woes, put the stuff away, and then I fell over. And I didn't come up smelling of it, I'll tell you. So, anyway, I was that impressed with my work. I had a bath, obviously.
Yeah.
But I picked up some more today, ready for tomorrow.
Right.
I'll tell you, I've only got four here.
Yeah.
I've got a woes garden princess.
Right.
I've got a rose mina. Some of these are climbing roses, some are normal.
Yeah.
I've got a rose parade, and I've got a Philadelphia Virginia or something. It's a white one, pink one, red one, and a yellow one. And I've got some multi compost because I don't think I'll use that stuff again tomorrow.
No, not if the odds are you're going to fall face down in it.
Well, I didn't come out. See, the thing is, well, that's the trouble. It's all right having manure and all this stuff mixed with compost, but, you know, there's a few hazards involved in it.
Yeah, it sounds like
you
it.
You know, and then I had to get in my car and that blooming stunk rather than I what.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, if you fall over in roses, you do want to come up smelling of roses.
Exactly, that's what I mean. I wanted to, but I didn't.
No, clearly.
It's quite a bit of a palaver, really, planting a couple of roses. It's just fun. The sun came out for about an hour today, didn't it?
Yeah, well...
It's been lovely.
Where are you? You're Essex, aren't you?
Essex, yeah. It was lovely today, about midday or something. I thought, do something constructive, plant a couple of roses, make the most of my daylight, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm over the other side of London, and from the moment I woke up, it was gorgeous. Put on a shirt, decided I'd get a sort of more of a spring jacket, left the house.
A t-shirt.
Blindly.
I fed the sparrows. I also fed the pigeons too. Give me a normal sense of well-being.
and then I'll think about leaving the house.
Then I was happy for the rest of the day, safe in the knowledge that blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It was nice, Rufus. Nice day. I hope you've had a good day as well, yeah?
Intertextual there. I mean, it started off David Bellamy via David Albarn. David? Damon Albarn. David Albarn. Yeah. He's Damon's brother.
And is Kath okay, yeah? A bit better?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, that's it, Kath. Keep your pepper up, yeah?
I'm trying. Do you know what? I thought I'm going to get my scooter out because the weather's started to look up.
Yeah.
Got it out of the garage.
Yeah.
It's been in there for a while. Battery's flat.
Yeah, well, it's going to happen.
I'm going to have to charge it up. It'll be nice again tomorrow, Kath, apparently. Well,
yeah?
I'm going to charge that bad boy up and I'm going to be steaming round on it like nobody's business.
Get your motor running.
Electric one, or is it a, one of them...
Petrol.
No, it's not petrol.
It's in a... Yes, it is. No, it's an Aprilia Habana Custom.
Oh, blimey, nice one. Is that a nice... An enduro or the racing type?
I'm going to say racing type.
Oh, they're brilliant, they are.
Oh, it's wonderful. What? I love it. It's my favourite thing ever.
Is it a 125?
Yes, it is.
Oh, excellent.
I'm not messing around CBT. With a 50.
Still on an L plate.
Of course I am,
Red and white and black. Or
black and
white.
It's black with a checkerboard pattern around, you know, like a racing...
17 sets of rear view mirrors.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Sounds like quite a rare one, actually. It sounds good.
It's gorgeous. It was a real find.
I think I said something about the cut-off switch
you were talking about. Did you get that sussed out?
It wasn't the cut-off switch that I was having a problem with. It was the battery. So, but you know when you get it out and you're thinking, you're trying to rev it and nothing's happening, then you're thinking, have I got the cut-off switch down?
Yeah, that's right.
I tried it every which way. I wasn't having anything.
Anything with two wheels, though, if you leave it sat for a few months without turning it over, you know that the battery's knackered.
So I'm going to charge it up. Rookie mistake. It won't happen again.
Is it electric start, Kath, or kick start?
Well, it's got both, but neither would have it yesterday.
If you charge it up and you're told just keep kipping it over, give it a bit of throttle and then just leave it, don't let it flood it, and then it should start,
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. So
I'll take the plug out and give it a quick clean if it hasn't been started for a while.
Top tips, thanks very much, I'll do that. But I was sat on my drive yesterday like a ripe pudding, I was ready to go, and I thought, oh, this ain't happening, this ain't happening.
You could have bump started it. You could have tried bump starting it. Put the ignition on, put the key on, then go down the road in first, then let the clutch out and see if it goes, yeah?
See, what it's I need is someone who knows about bikes, because I don't, so I just sat there like...
Yeah, I know a bit about them.
Like a pudding.
But I mean, scooter chat's all well and good, but it's no motorbike, is it?
I don't fancy one.
Yeah, well, that's because you're an idiot.
Kathy, don't you see me do tests and all that,
But I want to get rid of the L-plates because I do feel a bit of a prat on it with an L-plate.
Yeah, I passed my fury test first time on my motorbike, not my 125, obviously my bigger bike test, and then I was having my lessons, £100 a day that was costing me, and I had about five of them.
Yeah.
And anyway, I was going up the road on this 550. Everything was going fine, I had my microphones in here, do a left here, do a right there. Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, I want you to do an emergency stop in between two cones doing 40 miles an hour. Okay, so I've gone in and out the road. Got to
so 40. He's crashed through the front window of Baskin Robbins. What?
I've gone to the first cone, slammed on the back brake on its own, and the blinking brakes drifted, isn't it, all over the place. The bloke goes... I think you better try that again. So I went all the way back again, took the run up, tried to do the front wheel clutch and brake, front brake, clutch and back brake.
Yeah.
And it's drifted again away. He said, I think we better go back to the depot or back to the yard. Yeah. So I said, okay. So we're going back and he's saying, don't stop. So I had to pull over. And then I got to a roundabout, I stalled it in about fifth.
Oh, no.
And all I could hear in my microphone, don't stop, you can't talk back, can you?
No.
And because it's just a microphone in your ear under your crash helmet. So he said, we got back, he said, you do drive, didn't you? I said, of course I drive. He said, I think you might need another couple of lessons.
Oh, no. Yeah, 100 quid a day.
Yeah, it was £100 day, but it was good, quite intense. All the gear included, all the bike and the clothing and all that. But I was a bit, after drifting it and stole it, I'll probably, you know, a little while ago, I'll probably pick it up when I've got enough money for another couple of lessons, like, you know. Mm. But then I've got to do module one and module two.
Yeah.
To get the full bike test licence, yeah?
Well, I am. So, for anybody who doesn't know, for anybody who's not necessarily taken a keen interest in this kind of thing, it used to be, back in my dad's day, that if you got a driving licence, you could just get on a motorbike and ride it round. And then somebody twigged that wasn't terribly safe. So, there was a separate bike test brought in where you had to actually qualify to ride a bike. And that was a theory test. Which then got changed into a slightly more, I'm not really explaining this to you, Andre, just whoever's listening who doesn't necessarily know about this stuff, but they changed it to a theory test and a practical test. Then the theory test split off into two bits, so you did like a kind of multiple choice highway code test, and a computerized test where you watch a video on a computer screen. And when you're watching the video, you have to, I think, like, press the space bar or whatever, the moment you clock that there's a danger in view. And that it was all testing your reactions of, like, could you look far enough ahead? So you had to do the highway code bit, then that bit, and then once you'd done those two bits, you could go out and pass your test. Well, they changed that, and the law was going to change so that you had to do both of those two things. Then a day riding around a car, or, you know, like a car park through cones and whatever, and then another day out on the road. And everybody I spoke to at that time, because I was riding around on a CBT, was like, it's going to be a nightmare. It's not going to make anyone safer on the road. This is just people finding work for themselves. So I did my bike test about 2 days before they changed it into being that two-day test, and I've never looked back.
Do you remember when you could ride a 250 or anything up when you were 16?
Well, I didn't start riding a bike until about 2000 and, what are we on now, 2018. So, yeah, probably about 2009.
When I was 16, you could ride a 50 all day long, and then any time you wanted to after you're 16, get on a 250 and go brimming wheeling up the road as fast as anything. There's so many accidents, that's why they stopped it.
Yeah.
There's too many accidents.
Yeah.
Because imagine a 250, all their YZs and blimmin'. Not YZs, what were they? The Suzuki's and the Yamaha's and all that lot of fast ones.
Yeah.
Two strokes. They used to bring a flyer and that sort of had to stop that in the end. And then they brought in another one when he was actually 18 or 21 or something. And now it's what it is now. Well, there's two modules and a theory test.
Yeah.
Which is even harder.
Yeah. But it's almost as if they don't want people riding motorcycles, isn't it?
No, and a lot of people don't like them.
No.
That's the trouble.
Most people would be very happy if motorcyclists didn't exist. But the problem is, if you have been a motorcyclist, you will know that it is one of the truly great joys of being alive.
Yeah,
feels like you're flying in the summer. Yeah. You can get the open face helmet, feel the wind in your face, smell the world.
You can.
The first time, or the second time maybe, I went and played the Reading Festival. I had my 125. It's 40 miles from where I used to live to the Reading Festival.
Yeah.
And on an L plate, you can't go on the motorway. So
you used to be able to.
Yeah, you used to, on an L plate, you used to be able to, but you certainly by the time I was doing it, it just wasn't the rules. And I rode all these little back roads to get to the Reading Festival, and then finished it, was absolutely knackered. I mean, riding on a 125, you know, literally doing 50 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour all the way there.
It takes hours.
Oh, I was knackered.
On a motorbike, it does.
Went and did the gig, finished the gig, had to sort of wait a couple of hours to get the energy and the enthusiasm to ride back. Really didn't fancy it. So, get on the bike. It's getting dark. Well, it was dark by that point. And then came back and it was like a different world. All these little country roads, going past all these pubs, you could smell the wood smoke, the damp pine forests I was going through.
Oh my gosh. Everything's open in front of you, isn't it? When you're riding a bike down the road, it's not like being in a car all closing. Everything's open, you can see everything, can't you,
Yeah, you absolutely can. Listen, Andre, it's been a joy speaking to you. We've got to call it a day. I'll speak to you next time, hopefully. When we come back, Kath doesn't even know about this. When we come back, we've got a caller on the line that I've actually requested might be able to speak to us. We haven't spoken in person, neither have we spoken on Twitter. This has all been arranged through a third party. But when we come back, I'm going to be talking to Florence about the Vagina Museum.
Wow.
Yeah, which We can make cheap jokes about, but I think is a really brilliant and noble thing. And they've got a new project coming up that was met its Indiegogo sponsorship today. So we're going to be talking to Florence about that after this.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Take a trip into the alternate reality of Late Night Radio.
I think I'm in something like The Matrix, and so are you.
Speech Radio. Give a difference.
Is there anybody out there?
Late Night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
I mean, the voiceover guy already told you everything I'm about to tell you. My name is Rufus Hound. It's not just me, though, because Kat's here.
Yeah.
And I'm in for Ian Lee on the Late Night Alternative, the show where you decide what we talk about by phoning 03444991000. It was probably a more elegant way of putting that. However, for the next little bit, rather than it just being any old caller, it's somebody I've actively endeavoured to speak to. Her name is Florence. Hello, Florence.
Hi, Rufus. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very excited to be here. Well, virtually, I guess.
Yes. Listen, it's 2018. Do any of us truly exist if it's not down a wire or through a screen or out of a speaker? So, Florence, I'm going to give what I fear might be mansplaining, but is simply my job as a radio host to sort of try and, introduce people as to why we're speaking, and then please, immediately afterwards, put me right about all of the half-thought-through nonsense that spews out of my mouth. Would you mind?
Of course, I do it all the time.
Thank you ever so much. I sort of feel mansplaining's okay as long as you immediately explain that that is mansplain your mansplaining, and then defer to a far more intelligent woman. That's feels demi-forgivable.
I'll womansplain back to you.
Yeah, thank you, please. God, I mean, my whole life requires that sort of internal or external monologue. Florence, is it Schechter?
Yes, surname? That's right.
So, Florence Schechter. The reason that I've asked Florence to call is that on my Twitter feed, sort of totally in passing, somebody had retweeted a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo where they were, where Florence was trying to get the money together to put on a pop-up exhibition, which I think is the first kind of physical manifestation of this idea that you have had called the Vagina Museum. Is that right, Florence?
Yeah, we've been doing the Vagina Museum for about a year now, but this is going to be our first sort of proper exhibition. We did a really small art exhibition at Edinburgh Fringe Festival that just went, but this is going to be our first, like, big exhibition that we're doing.
So this was as a direct sort of answer, I suppose. People have heard, I think, of the Penis Museum. Is it in Iceland?
It is. It's amazing. It's in Iceland.
So for anybody who hasn't heard of the Penis Museum, can you... I mean, I only know a little bit about it. It's basically a museum full of penises, like animal penises, and the history of kind of male penis representation in art and cave paintings and things like that, isn't it?
It's not nearly as extensive as that, I'm afraid. Oh. It's literally just animal penises in jars and stuff. It basically was born out of the founder. He was a biology teacher, and he had a collection of animal penises, and he would have them in his office, and the students could come and see them, but the collection got so big that he couldn't fit it in his office anymore, and he went to the Icelandic Council and was like, could I have a building to put these in? And they were like, yeah. And so the Penis Museum was born.
Wow. But you realised there was no female version thereof. A vagina museum existed nowhere on Earth.
No, there was no, like, vagina equivalent. There is no bricks and mortar vagina museum anywhere in the world. There's, like, some medical museums, there's a contraception and abortion museum, there's a menstruation museum, but there's no vagina museum. So, I'm making one.
Yeah, if the story hasn't been written that you want to read, write it.
Exactly.
I think I'm probably paraphrasing that aphorism poorly. What are the hopes and aspirations of the Vagina Museum?
Mm, So I think it's, for me, it's sort of threefold. I want people to, for education, for empowerment, and for entertainment. So basically, there's a lot of misinformation about vaginas out there. And that, like, that's a real problem. Then I want people to be empowered when they come to it, because it's a subject that's like surrounded with a lot of taboo. About 65% of women in Britain cannot even say the word vagina or vulva. And that is, this is having massive implications. A third of women in Britain admitted avoiding going to the doctor when they had gynecological symptoms because they were embarrassed. And also I want the museum to be fun, because why not?
Yeah, yeah. So, does it currently exist as a bricks and mortar concern?
What, does the museum exist?
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose the thing is that I didn't quite have time to properly research, because literally I've been working all day, and it was. I only know her as Knickknack on Twitter.
Yes, that's Niharika. She's one of our trustees. She's amazing.
Yeah.
She's Knickknack on Twitter, yeah. So we've been doing this project for about a year now. And so it's not opened yet. It takes a very long time to build museums. So the plan is we're going to have this pop-up exhibition. Then we're going to have an interim museum, which is just like a little small proof of concept. And then we'll build the permanent museum.
Wow. So long term, where would that be based?
Probably somewhere in London. I kind of secretly, and obviously not so secretly because I'm saying it on the radio, would love to have it in Holloway Prison, because it's, you know, up for sale at the moment.
Right.
But, I mean, that's probably not going to happen. But in my dream, yeah, it would be in Holloway Prison.
Hey, shoot for the moon, because if you miss, you still end up with the stars. So, let's talk then specifically about this pop-up exhibition. It is called...
Is your vagina normal? Spoiler, yes, it is.
Which was an amazing title, because I think, especially at the moment when we're, you know, sort of in the public consciousness is debating the ideas of, you know, what is normal and, you know, the gender ramifications of the idea of a thing being normal and therefore something else being abnormal. The idea of is your vagina normal just struck me as being immediately quite funny.
Yeah, well, I know I've definitely asked myself this loads of times, and I know loads of my friends have. And so what I really want is to have, like, you know, a tent in the middle of a festival or something with a big banner that says, is your vagina normal? And loads of people will come over and ask the people at the workshops, like, is it? And then all of them will be like, yes, yes, it is. Come learn about the vagina and the vulva. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be quite a lighthearted thing.
What do you imagine will be taking place in the exhibition?
So it's going to be like activities based rather than objects based. So you're going to be learning like educational stuff rather than history. So we're going to have three themes. Does your vagina look normal? Does it smell normal? And does it feel normal? And there's going to be lots of like activities and things. So something I really want to do is we get like, you know, those models that midwives use to practice like, you know, doing deliveries.
As a father of two children who has been to those classes, trust me that I do.
Well, I want one of those, and then I'm going to stick some pubic hair on top of it, and then you get to style the pubic hair, and we can just, like, normalise pubic hair as a thing. You know, like those dolls for little kids where you style their hair and you put it in plastic?
Yeah.
I want to do that. That's one of the things I want to do.
Phenomenal. So, okay, so we can do a bit of pube combing.
Yeah, and then I think another thing that would be really fun is film your Kegel face. So everyone should do their Kegels. It's super important, even men. Because did you know, men who work on their Kegel muscles, you get longer and stronger erections. So everyone should work on their Kegels.
Okay, wait, so I'm going to need to rewind you ever so slightly here.
Oh, yeah.
What is a Kegel?
Oh, so it's like the pelvic floor. So the pelvic floor is the muscles in your pelvis that basically stop your insides falling out. and it's really important that they're strong because, like, you know, in people with vaginas, it means you don't leak when you laugh. It gives you better orgasms. And, you know, during childbirth, it keeps everything kind of, stops it ripping apart.
Right.
So it's really important to exercise them. They're called pelvic floor exercises, or they're also called Kegel exercises.
And is this something on the radio that we can explain to people how to do a Kegel?
Oh, yeah. So there's loads of different ways. I'm going to steal the technique that's taught by Elaine Miller, who's a pelvic floor physiotherapist. She's also a comedian called Gusset Grippers, and she does a comedy show where you learn how to do your pelvic floor. So this is how you do it. Okay, so you want to clench your pelvic floor. And the way you do that is like, you know that feeling when you need to fart and you've got to hold it in?
Yeah.
So do that and hold it for 10 seconds.
All right, hang on, wait, here we go then. Okay. Everybody listening, right, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, there is no reason not to be doing it. If you can listen to the radio, you can sure as hell do a Kegel for 10 seconds. So, we're going to clench, and it should feel like we're trying to hold in a fart. Is that as good a description as any? Right, so here we go then.
For men, just a little tip, or for people with penises, the way to imagine it is like, you know when you're in the sea and the water's really cold, so you like clench everything up so your balls aren't touching the cold water.
Yes.
You can also, if you want to think about it like that, you can also do that.
Okay. Two excellent descriptions. So, here we go then. A 10-second Kegel. We'll count down from 3, 2, 1, and clench.
And hold.
And we're holding. And we're holding. And we're holding. Oh, we're at 5 seconds. Four, three, two, one. Oh,
yeah. And then there's like lots of different other exercises you can do, and that's just one of them.
And should we be kind of doing repetitions? This is like any other exercise that we do, kind of one Kegel and then rest and then another and that's
yeah.
Sort of thing.
So what I personally do is I do that one. We hold it for 10 seconds, yeah. And then you want to do 10 flicks. So like really quick, hold, release. Hold, release, and do that 10 times.
Okay.
And then you want to do what is sort of affectionately called the elevator, which is where you hold, and then you hold a bit tighter, and then you hold a bit tighter, and then you let go very slowly. It's like an elevator. So you go from floor 1 to floor 2 to floor 3, and then you go all the way back down to floor 1.
Wow. Yeah.
And then do that like 2 or 3 times a day, and you will see the difference, let me tell you.
Stronger erections for penis owners, better orgasm for owners of vaginas.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Well, I mean, let me be honest and say, if this isn't improving your life, then I don't know what is, dear Talk Radio listener. So, we've got pubic topiary. We've got Kegels.
That's a good name for it. I might steal that.
Oh, by all means. Pubic topiary, and then the strap line underneath is, let's make that bush look good.
I love it.
Yeah, it's all yours. So we got that, we got the Kegels, and what else?
Oh, am I going to pitch the whole thing to you? I'm just going to teach you how to do it, and you can come and do the workshops for us.
Well, I mean, it's only that I... Here's the reason, right, so I retweeted it and I said to people, come on, let's throw some money in. I've got some, like, weird hang-ups at the moment about my position as a white man of privilege and what I should be supporting and what it is culturally insensitive to support. So the weird thing is, I remember reading an article a little while ago about how young women in the post-internet porn age had this, were encouraged, you know, encouraged, but culturally had felt encouraged that if they didn't have zero pubic hair and this sort of, you know, perfect, in inverted commas, vagina, you know, with everything... kind of, you know...
All trim and Barbie-like.
Thank you very much. It's, again, it troubles me as a man to have to explain those things. But there's this idea of this kind of perfect vagina.
Mm.
And as a man who has been married for 10 years, I've only seen... Well, 11 years. I've only seen one vagina in all of that time. But historically, I have seen other vaginas. And they come in a range of shapes and sizes and, you know, colours and flavours. But
you really do.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's it, right? And I have been grateful to have any vagina that's ever been shared with me shared with me. I wouldn't ever hold one up and say, oh, that was a good one and that was a bad one. They are what they are. They're attached to the person they're attached to. They do what they do. They're, you know, they have different quirks and different, you know, the operator manual on each has been kind of, you know, varied, and it's part of your job and your responsibility to find out how it works best and do that thing to it, with it, on it,
absolutely,
near it, you know.
there's such a huge diversity. Labiaplasties are up fivefold on the NHS in the past 10 years. And a lot of it attribute it to online porn. But as an antidote, there are two things I would recommend you checking out. One of them is Labia Library, which is an online library of various different people's vulvas. It's Australian. And also the Great Wall of Vagina, which is, it's like a cast, it's 400 casts of lots of people's vulvas. So it is a misnomer. It should be called the Great Wall of Vulva, but then it wouldn't be a pun.
No. Especially the way Donald Trump says it. China. You know, China. China.
Maybe he is referencing Jamie McCartney's work of 2011.
Well, we know he's an enormous fan of esoteric sex education, so I'm sure that's what it is. Yeah, so that was the thing. It felt like what little I dimly understand about all of this stuff is what I do understand is that women are encouraged to hate themselves and their bodies in a myriad of ways, and the kind of the one of the great remaining taboos is about the idea of what your vagina should be, as opposed to joyfully accepting the brilliance of what it is. And therefore this felt incredibly worthwhile, and I think you're doing God's work.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, it's true, right? Because I'll be honest, not to immediately take a thing of female empowerment and turn it male, but the number of men, it seems to me, that have this kind of core hang-up about their dick, and then, grimly deny it, and then that fuels their raging psychopathy in business or, banking or whatever else.
It's, fast cars.
Yeah, exactly. Driving an Audi up your backside as you're trying to, tootle along the M1. But it feels to me that that's always a kind of macho thing of, and it's on the outside, and look how big it is, and look at what it does, look how straight it is, or how uncut or cut or, whatever else. Whereas, vaginas, it's a harder thing to kind of, promote, accept, encourage vagina owners to be okay with, or to not be panicked about, or for it just not to be another thing on the laundry list of ways in which we encourage women to feel crap about themselves.
It's almost like we live in a society that institutionally oppresses women.
I don't know why for a moment you would think that.
but men do, penis owners do get a lot of genital shame as well. I'm absolutely not denying that. There's just a lot of genital shame to go around.
Yeah.
And we need to fight it.
Yes, we do. I wholly agree.
Wholly?
Genuinely, no pun intended. I really thought I was being pretty good so far in resisting any of the cheap schoolboy puns that could be. But I'm delighted to know that, Florence, you haven't.
No, I'm just as childish as the rest of us.
Thank God. Well, look, it's been a delight speaking to you. Thanks so much for phoning in.
Oh, thanks so much for asking us to phone in.
And congratulations on getting funded. And people will see you around and about at various festivals across the country, will they?
Yeah, absolutely. Keep donating, though, because the more money we get, then the more places we can go, and maybe we can come to your town or your city.
Good stuff. For anybody who wants to throw a couple of rupees into this, into your pop-up, what's the, even as I was searching for the words, I realised that wasn't the right way of putting it, but I ploughed on gallantly. What's the Indiegogo? Where should people head?
So you can either go to our website, which is www.vaginamuseum.co.uk, and there's a pop-up thing there. Or if you literally just go to Indiegogo and search vagina, we're like number one or number two or something.
Very good. Florence, an absolute treat speaking to you. Thanks very much for phoning in.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Well, fascinating stuff. Hopefully that's alerted you to the fact that you can still throw them a few bob. Hopefully, maybe you've been encouraged to Kegel, because it just seems to me if you own genitals, there's no reason not to. So why wouldn't you? This is the Late Night Alternative. It's you who sets the agenda. Admittedly, with our last caller, that was Florence, who I had, you know, encouraged to phone in, so that was a little bit of agenda setting from my end. But were you to pick up your telephone and call 0344 499 1000, let's just say you may be able to slide into the call roster, because currently it's a little bare. And by which I don't mean boo-boo. 0344 499 1000, pick up your telephone, give us a ring, and let's have a chat. So, Kath?
Yeah?
Going anywhere nice on your holidays?
No, my parents are driving me nuts about that. They always do every year. They are...
Are they retired?
Almost.
Right.
Right. They're of a generation where if you don't go on holiday every year, you're some kind of nut job.
Right.
And it's kind of...
Is it important that you go away?
Yeah.
Right.
That whole thing. Whereas we kind of want to decorate the house. And in the list of priorities, spaffing like $2,000 on a holiday,
yeah,
when the house is like falling apart seems a little bit decadent. So we've kind of set in our heads that we will stay at home maybe this year and do stuff with the kids. I mean, that's the important thing, right? We had this thing a couple of years ago called the Pot of Possibilities. It was a jar. And I put all these little bits of paper in there with all these different ideas for days out or just activities. Like we camped in the back garden one night, or we went and found this woodland near us has got an aerial walkway, and we did that. And so it might be expensive. It might not be. We did a teddy bear's picnic, or we went to the cinema, or, you know, it's all little things. And then some big things like Legoland, which never came out, actually, the possibilities, it's still in there waiting.
Lurking.
Or going off to Brighton for the day, you know, on the train, because the kids just enjoy the train part, weirdos. So we might do that this year. And they do keep asking about it and saying, when are we going to do the possibilities again? Rather than, when are we going to go and lie on a beach while you drink?
Where's Malaga?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we might do that this year.
How do you feel about camping?
I hate it, but the kids love it.
Right.
Admittedly, we've only done the back garden so far. And it was the best night's sleep I've had for ages because of all the fresh air.
Yeah.
And also, I think we're on a slight slope, so all the blood was going to my head. But I think the kids would like it. I think they'd get a kick out of it. But
I was not raised in a camping family at all.
No, me neither.
And therefore, it's always been kind of a distant thing. However, at the end of the summer term, a group of local mums and dads get their kids from school on the last day of term, throw them into cars, head towards some woods near Bracknell, and a camp is erected. And the first 3 days of the summer holidays, traditionally, are spent with about, I think it's about seven families, eight families all together with the kids, because it's the beginning of summer, go, but all together, running around in the woods, huge pots of stew and all of that get made. Adults basically drinking, as you suggest, from morning till night.
Yes.
Dens get built, axes are taken, and it's a phenomenal way to like kind of kick off the summer holidays, because the kids get loads of fresh air. That initial burst of excitement is both endorsed and contained.
Yeah.
And the being together is really wonderful. And then late nights, just sat around fires with, you know, all these people that, you know, you might see here and there, but you don't necessarily spend a huge amount of quality time with. And reading stories to kids before bedtime on the campfire and marshmallows is really, really good. And I've come to be an enormous fan of camping. Get one of those like old-fashioned canvas bell tents with one big pole goes up in the middle, peg the whole thing down. Mm-hmm. You can put it up almost single-handedly. You know, if you're committed, you can put it up single-handedly. But two of you get it up in like 6-7 minutes. And, you know, loads of rugs in the bottom, you know, mattress. Those little, like, thin memory foam mattresses.
Yeah, that's not cheating, is it?
Oh, no, not at all.
No, it's fine.
And it's absolutely lovely. In those tents, you wake up and the sun comes in through the canvas, that you're in this sort of light orb. Almost, I mean, it's not an orb because it's not round, but you know what I mean? You're in this sort of light space, loads of fresh air, as you say, amazing night's sleep.
Yeah.
You know, it's a phenomenal thing. And it doesn't have to cost the earth.
No.
Most people who've got tents aren't using them all the time. So if you find a mate who's got one...
We've got a tent because we have one for the back garden.
Right, there you go.
It was only a cheapo one,
yeah.
But, you know, we're not going to be doing all terrain.
No, you're not going to go up.
We're not going up Everest. We're not gonna be...
Yeah.
That's next year.
We're not really into camping, so we thought this year we'd try and scale Everest.
Without any respiratory aid.
Oh, you'd be fine.
No, I think
do it as a gang and get out there. It's super, you know, it really doesn't have to be expensive. If you go a bit further afield and be somewhere that you haven't been before, and you can go do all day trips. But I think doing it kind of communally, oh man, there's nothing like it. Even if you've got like two people that you really like, and then the rest of people you're not that bothered about, and even a couple that you can't stand, by the end of it,
you'll have swapped round.
You'll have come together in a way that, you know, you weren't expecting, and it is a life enriching experience.
Well, it sounds glorious.
That has my record. Stick that in your pot of possibilities and smoke it.
Well, I might. And the thing is about that pot as well is that the kids are the ones that pick it out the night before.
Oh,
so
wow.
They feel like they're the masters of the universe, you know.
Congratulations for developing a system of ensuring your children will absolutely not go to sleep for 3 hours.
Oh, well, you know, there's no dipping in the pot if you've been naughty.
Right. Are we still talking about the pot? Well, maybe we'll leave it and take a caller. Lewis has phoned in. Hello, Lewis.
Hey.
Hey, hey.
Hey.
How are you, sir? Yeah, good. Thank you, mate. How are you?
Oh, good, thanks. I just ring in. I don't know if you remember or not. You probably don't. But the last time you was on, I called in and I had the story about Batman and Freddy Krueger. Do you remember that?
I do. It had come to you as a sort of weird fever dream and you thought that maybe this had legs as a screenplay.
Yeah, well, it didn't.
Who knew?
But I got a new one.
Oh, great. Lovely.
So, I haven't used any characters that have already been thought of.
Very good, you see.
I know. I started well.
Yeah.
But it's just basically, it's about this vampire, right? And he lives in Dalston. And he wants to be trendy, so he's become a vegan. And, and there's this cafe, and they sell vegan blood for vampires. He's bought a bicycle and everything and grown a beard and that. I'm pretty stuck on what to do with it. I just wanted to ring in to say hi, really. And that's, you know.
That's a perfectly good enough reason, Lewis. Are you hoping we can kind of workshop this script?
It's not a script. It's turned into like a book.
Oh, okay. Very good. So yeah, it's a vegan vampire. See, it feels to me that you've got to make a choice. Either we meet a vegan vampire... who's living in Dalston and has got a bicycle, and now we've got to work out what journey that character's going to go on, or we meet an absolute monstrous Nosferatu, and then we track him over his journey towards becoming a vegan with a bicycle who lives in Dalston. Do you know what I mean?
Well, but he's pretty cool. Like, he's 25, and his name's Vic.
It's only five?
He's 25.
Oh, he's 25? He's into music?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
All right.
He likes Nirvana and stuff.
And he's so happy because today he found his friend?
Yeah, and he shaved his head.
Okay.
Yeah, so, man.
Well, that's that feels like a good character, but I think you've got to... What's he going to find out about the world or himself?
Well, he's been around for a while, but it's just, I don't know, man.
Yeah. Tricky, isn't it?
You know?
Yeah. This writing lark. Everyone thinks it's a piece of cake, but you got to work it all out. I'll give you a little book recommendation if you want.
Okay.
It's a book called The Last Werewolf, and it's by Glenn Duncan. I think Glenn's got two N's.
Okay.
And it... It is a sort of werewolf equivalent of what you're talking about.
Okay.
He's the last werewolf on Earth. He's been around for a while. He knows everything about what it means to be a werewolf, and he's just over it. He's got, you know, he's got a pretty good life. Everything's sorted. He knows where he is and what he's about, but he's the last werewolf, and all he wants to do is kill himself.
That's the kind of vibe I'm going for with this, man.
Right. Okay. So, it's a trilogy, The Last Werewolf, but you can just read the first one, and that'd be perfectly good enough. You don't necessarily get to the end with a kind of overwhelming sense of like, oh, but there are so many ends not tied up. I'll be honest, by the end, there are a couple of loose ends that haven't been tied up. It's certainly enough to make you want to read the rest of the trilogy. But the actual story itself...
The Last Vampire, Part 3.
So I think it's The Last Werewolf, Tallulah Rising, and Let There Be Blood or something.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to remember. Maybe Tallulah Rising's the third one. But, yeah, it's something like that. But I have rarely read a better written book in my life than The Last Werewolf.
Wow, man.
It kind of really uses, you know, the fantasy tropes of werewolves and all that kind of stuff to examine the kind of existential ennui, the sadness that we can all feel when we're just like, oh, I'm just over this. Oh, God. You know, why do I have to carry on with all this? It's just, you know, oh, great, I can do this, oh, this doesn't make me special, you know, and yet all kind of viewed through the eyes of somebody who knows that they're a monster. Anyway, fantastic. I heartily recommend it.
Oh, wow, thank you, man. Can I recommend a book for you?
Please.
It's the author's name's Tom Robbins.
Right.
And the book is called Still Life with Woodpecker. Have you heard of it?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay, hang on. Let me just go and get it.
See, this is what happens over the course of the show, isn't it? Is that we start with Alan Caddick basically just telling us what he's watching on the telly, and by the time we get to 20 to midnight, we've got people ringing in with book recommendations and museum curators. We definitely get classier as we wear on, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, right, here we go. Still Life with Woodpecker is a sort of love story that takes place inside a packet of Camel cigarettes. It reveals the purpose of the moon, explains the difference between criminals and outlaws, examines the conflict between social activism and romantic individualism, and paints a portrait of contemporary society that includes the powerful Arabs, exiled royalty, and pregnant cheerleaders. It also deals with the problems of redheads. And, basically, it's this woodpecker, and he's a suicide bomber. But he falls in love with a princess who is a cigarette. my dad gave it to me. He got it in 1972, and it made him travel around the Middle East in the 70s.
Wow.
Yeah, it's Tom Robbins, Still Life with Woodpecker. That is really cool, man.
All right, hang on a sec, right? Just keep talking, so that'll buy me time to type Still Life with Woodpecker into Amazon. So, okay. Just all I'm saying is, it's on you now, Lewis. Phil, right? Just keep talking.
Yep. 0344-499-1000. Flipping Cat is on the decks, and Rupert Hound is emceeing.
Gosh,
welcome,
can you imagine?
To the party.
I haven't finished. I'm still typing. There we go. Still Life with Woodpecker. All right. Well, I'm on a very well known book site named after a river, and it's on there for $9.99. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'm on Ganges.com. Paperback $9.99, or available in hardcover for £659.41.
But which will you choose?
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it? Just like the feel of a hardback book. Do you know what I mean,
Kath? We all do.
Just feels to me that it's worth the additional I can't do the maths. English, not maths. All right, well, look, I will. I'm going to log in and buy that based on that recommendation.
Wow.
It's, what's that? 4-star reviews across the board. Let's see.
But if it's rubbish, he will hunt you down and he will find you.
I'm going to send you the invoice.
Hunt me down, man. You can find me on Portobello Road.
Wow. I really had no idea what to rate this book. I was thinking one or two stars because I really had no idea what the hell I was reading. But then I came to the conclusion, because I don't understand something, should I really rate it lower than it truly deserves? I understand the gist of it, but a part of me is thinking there's more to the random babbling than meets the eye. It's easy to not appreciate something that you don't understand, but I'd like to think I appreciated this book. Tom Robbins clearly has a very unique writing style. It's very different, and only certain people have the ability to pull it off. I think he did a very good job. It might be easier to understand if you're on the same substance as he was when he wrote the book, but I don't think
that's
it's
what
necessary.
My dad said. He said, you need to take LSD when you're eating this.
what a weird parental lesson to pass over. All right, well, look, Lewis, that'll be a joy to plough into that when I can do anything other than read a script and try and learn all of it. But, Lewis, tip-top. Thanks for your time, man.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. And Kath, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Oh, it's a right old book exchange. Rest assured. Oh, I've got people tweeting me, links for things and all sorts. So,
You'll never be without a book again.
Never be without a book. Well, it's sort of a problem, though. It used to be the case that it's all about price points and living in a consumerist society. Where we go back now? About 25 years ago, when I just had my sort of first Saturday job and whatever, you know, found it very hard to walk past a record shop without just sort of popping, I'll just have a look, you know, there might be something. You know, always coming home with a CD, basically that. And then got a little bit older and it was like CDs and, it started off with books and comics, books, comics and magazines, CDs, DVDs, fags. And it's like all those things at that price point, you're like, I'll cheer myself up, I'll get a little something. And then all of those things have fallen away because now you've got streaming, you don't go and buy DVDs.
I've got room for them, have you?
Why would you need room for them? Streaming again, don't need CDs, gave up fags. So it's like, where's that thing at that price point? And books never went away. Just can't basically walk past a Foyles or a Waterstones or, you know, a fine independent bookshop.
Yeah, because, you know, although if you know what you want, it's really easy just to get on that certain website, Amazon, and and help fill your boots, right?
Yeah.
I do like having a browse and seeing something that I wasn't looking for, you know?
Yeah.
And have something leap. And judging some books by covers, I'm going to be honest.
Well, I can't remember. I think there's a stand-up that made a whole thing of it that was the book industry literally spends millions of dollars every year working out the demographic likelihood of how you're going to... So judge a book by its cover. It's one of the most studied, put together, deliberately placed choices made in modern consumerism. Judge the book by its cover.
Also, I'll read the, you know, if it's got reviews on it and it's, you know, phenomenal, Stephen Fry.
Yeah.
Thumbs up. Blinding the Star goes back.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yes, that's, we're encouraged to make choices based on previous experience.
Yeah.
And then what you learn as you get older is, but all your previous experience has confirmed for you is the person you already are.
Yes.
How do you break out of that? That's why we, you know, live in media, social media bubbles and all of that. How do we break out of it? Maybe Yian's got some answers. What do you think? Well, let's find out. Hello, Yian. Hello, Yian. Yian, ah, oh, Yian, oh, Yian, oh, Yian, oh, Yian, oh, Yian, oh, Yian, oh, Yian. Are you there? He's not there.
Return to innocence.
This could be the return to yourself.
What happened to those guys?
The return to innocence. Enigma.
Enigma.
Ah, exactly.
They were the reason I ended up buying Moods and Moods 2. I couldn't bring myself to buy a whole Enigma album, but I could manage a Moods. Them, Candy Dulfer.
Yeah. There was a few things. I couldn't even tell you what it was now.
Kenny G.
Oh, really? Oh, Kenny G?
They were all on there. It wasn't my fault. Yikes. I didn't really like them. I did. I really liked them.
I can't remember the name of it now. I had a kind of chill out album.
Was it Café Del Mar? Everyone had that one.
No. It was a chill out album based on Native American folk music.
Wow. Yeah. Did you get that at a service station or a gardening centre?
No, I got it from a specialist record shop in Farnham.
Ouch!
Yeah. my best mate's dad paid me to help him clear his garden. And with the half of the money he gave me, I was just walking past the record shop. Just, it was burning a hole in my pot. I couldn't not.
What haven't I got?
Oh my God, I just need to just buy a record. And at that time, you know, grunge is just bursting through. If I'd have been a bit more foresighted, maybe I'd have seen indie coming down the pipeline. Jamiroquai had just had Emergency on Planet Earth out. So, you know, maybe there was something of the acid funk jazz realm available. And, no, none of that. Chill beats placed over Native American folk music.
I'm pretty sure that's not what the fathers of America wanted.
I think they wanted to be left the bloody hell alone.
I know. Never mind culturally appropriating them with some sick beats.
Yeah, yeah. Not smallpox was probably top of the list. An approach towards Buffalo that was more... coercive than it was shoot them as many as possible of them from a train.
Yeah, all those things.
Well, I mean, the list goes on, doesn't it? It's easy to nitpick in 2018 about the genocide of native peoples.
I saw a woman driving around the other day with a dream catcher in her car. Surely that shouldn't be necessary.
Yeah. Oh, we'll get us a board in traffic. Yeah. Oh God. Have you? There's I don't know if it's still on iPlayer, or maybe it's on the internet by now elsewhere. I don't know. Rich Hall did a documentary about the South. I think it was, but a big part of it was about the cultural appropriation of Native American culture.
Right.
And so, basically, any time you see a dream catcher or a headdress, I mean, you may as well be wearing a swastika. I mean, it's that bad. Really horrifically. I was always quite into, oh, yeah, you know, a skull with a head. Oh, you know, it looks quite...
Yeah,
well,
I mean, they're
now.
Beautiful things, aren't they?
I mean, they are beautiful things, but they are beautiful
things... They have a meaning.
...that belong to a culture that we systemically wiped from the face of the earth. Anyway.
And then popped on their own reserve, like that was a favour.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
and then,
guys, chill out.
And then refused to protect.
Yeah.
Have you seen, there's a new film out, well, relatively new, in the last 6 months called Wind River?
No, not seen it.
It's amazing. It's an amazing film. You must see it if you can, right? It's up there with the Billboards film.
Oh, wow.
In one of those films where I didn't know what it was going to be, but it was just... And you don't really enjoy it, you kind of endure it, but it's such a powerful film, it's wonderful. Incredible. And that's all set on an Indian reservation.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, based on the fact that women do get raped and murdered and go missing on these reservations, and there's little to no policing of them because it's left to the tribal police and the outside world doesn't seem to care.
Yikes.
And you've got people going onto the reservations and basically doing all manner of unspeakable things to these women because they're not a priority. Not a priority at all. Disappearing.
Oui.
So it's one of those films. It's an amazing film.
See, if I was a better person, I would hear you say that and think, I'm going to bloody well watch that.
Yeah.
But I can be honest with you and say that you say all that. I was like...
No, I can't.
My awareness of the world being horrible is already pretty high. Having more detail about the ways in which the world is horrible. Just when I get to that little bit of leisure time at the end of the night, the idea of like... Take a deep breath. Right, now we're going to wade into the fact that, you know...
Maybe should have tricked you and said it was a light-hearted romp.
That's it. Seth Rogen stars as... Well, look.
Jeremy Renner's in it.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he's belting.
Oh, is he good in it?
He's so good in it. I think that's who it is. Let me just check. I said
the
that
guy
with
was
such
in
conviction.
The Bourne movie that wasn't Matthew... Matt Damon. Is that him? Jeremy Renner?
Yeah, it is Jeremy Renner. I was right. Oh, God,
Hawkeye.
If you want, yeah.
What do you mean, if I want? Those Avengers movies are amongst the most...
I've never seen them.
Ugh. What? Why? Why are we even...
I know.
Like, in the same...
I know.
...world?
Just accidental, really.
It's awful. An absolute bloody insult. I come here ready to share some of my most thought-through, brilliant thoughts about modern popular culture, and I'm sitting next to a woman who hasn't even seen the effing Avengers. How, what am I? I'm just meant to take that on the chin. Move on. Move on with the world. Just pretend like it hasn't happened.
Camera 2, over here. He thinks I can't hear him just because he's facing the other way.
Oh, could you hear all that?
Yeah. Your inner monologue is leaking somewhat.
Is my inner monologue normal?
I've had a look at it. I can testify that no, it isn't.
No, it is not. Feel shame. Hey, look, guess what? Yian might have phoned back up. Shall we see if he has? Are you there, Yian?
Hey,
there you are.
I just wanted to phone about, I was listening into Friday night show and I heard someone having a discussion of the heat of the moment thing about school teachers.
Oh, I.
Yeah, and they was arguing about the presenter was saying the teachers was boring and one of the children, someone rang up saying they're not boring. And I think, on the both sides, I think teachers are boring and I do question them and personally, they must be nuts. Teaching the same subject day in, day out, just learning, just teaching the same subject all the time. Like, you're just doing it all at my topic. They're like, oh, we've done this topic before. But like, at all through Columbine Primary, I've always had a close bond with the LCs, which is like, help the teachers. So
you're phoning, you're phoning from a position of what, Yian? Are you a student?
I used to be, but
we all used to be, Yian. It doesn't make you special, Claire.
No, I'm just saying I left college in January due to circumstances.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah.
And but how are you getting on with that?
So I work with someone now closer to my house, one-on-one, and I find that's helping and is a lot better.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and I see, because I live in the same town as my college now, I see them a lot of the time, like, on their breaks now, wandering around town, and I think it's quite rude. They don't even speak to me, or the staff don't. Like, last week, I seen the staff and pupils in town, and they didn't speak to me, but then after work, I seen one of the teachers on room doing shopping, and then she was speaking to me, so I found mad at things, so I did email the head of the department and told them and they sorted it out.
Well, I'm glad it all got sorted out, Yian. Thank you. Well, sorry, mate, I apologise. We tried to come to you earlier. I don't know why it didn't work, but it didn't.
Oh, mate, no.
Well, we're about to roll up to the news. So,
enjoy the news.
Will do, mate. Enjoy everything.
Thank you. You too, and good evening, Catherine.
Good evening to you.
Let you carry on with the news and the adverts.
News and adverts. It's basically the only reason we're here. The rest of this is just filler. Look, we're going to be back after, as Yian elegantly put it, the news and the adverts. But we would like to be back with you. So pick up your telephone, 0344 499 1000. It's the late night alternative. You set the agenda, friends, and without you, there is no agenda. There's just Kath and I talking about films we've seen, books we've read.
And privates.
And genitals. Maybe that's what you're into, you sicko. But for God's sake, the very least you could do is join in with this nonsense. 0344 499 1000, the number to call. You can tweet us at Talk Radio or indeed send us a text message. 87222, the number. You start the message with the word talk. It'll cost you 25p in your standard network rate.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Take a trip into the alternate reality of late night. Night Radio.
I think I'm in something like The Matrix, and so are you.
Speech Radio, with a difference.
Is there anybody out there?
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
He's not wrong. That is who I am. No mention of Kath, though, which feels...
I mean, who's she?
Who is she? Who is this enigma?
She thinks she is.
Wrapped in a Pandora's box. Bocked?
Bocked?
Box. It's definitely after midnight. It's the last hour. I've just given up on speaking.
It's overrated. God,
it's overrated, isn't it? I mean, you know, why can't radio just be humming? Should we try that? Hum radio. We'll get you humming. Sounds wrong. I can see why. I can see now why they started to talk.
Yeah.
It's the late night alternative. It's very simple. You ring up. We talk about whatever you want to talk about. 0344 499 1000. The switchboard, relatively clear, but for my best friend, Barry. Hello, Barry.
Hey, Rufus, you're a good man. It's lovely to see you, to hear you back this evening, Rufus.
Radio paints all the pictures in your mind, so in some ways, Barry, you are seeing me.
And good evening, Catherine.
Hello, Barry.
Yeah, I'm interested on your little bit, I think, at the beginning of the programme. Was I right in hearing that you'd been to Chile?
Yes. So, a slight story attached to this, which involves me being an idiot. And the way in which I'm an idiot is I hosted an auction for a charity, and the charity's auction prizes were in what they called Christmas stockings. So you bid on a Christmas stocking that was provided, in inverted commas, by a celebrity. And so I think, like, the Duchess of York's stocking was tea with her at some, you know, posh London, like Claridge's or something like that. And a holiday or a hotel somewhere, and a pair of shoes from somewhere. You know, they got together loads of prizes, but they bundled them all up, and you could bid on each of these stockings. Well, one of the last lots of the night was the Gregory Porter stocking, and I really like Gregory Porter, and it was tickets to see him in Belgium with Eurostar tickets. There and back, and I thought, oh, that sounds fantastic. Basically, all of these things were going for, you know, small fortunes, but because it's one of the last ones in the night, I thought, well, look, it's Christmas. This charity, it was Macmillan Nurses, right? Like, I've had a pretty good year. If I go to a couple of grand on this, just to get a bid in, who knows, might go my way. Well, I'd been hosting the event, so everybody in the room knew who I was. Sure enough, most of the money's dwindled off. This package is going for next to no money. So I put my hand in the air. And this is why I'm stupid. Because in an auction, where basically people are bullied into upping the ante all the time, once I'd bid once, everybody in this room just bellowed at me until I bid against the next person bidding. And the money went up and up and up. And I got on the microphone and said to everybody, you don't understand. My wife will kill me if I go, you know, above this figure. This is all getting out of hand. It's too much money. Nobody in that room gave two hoots. So I ended up paying a really fairly, like, breathtaking sum of money. It was definitely more than $2,000 for this package of things that was ostensibly really the only bit I was interested in, was going to see Gregory Porter in Brussels, which we did and was incredible. But one of the other parts of it was a four-night stay in one of these, like, really incredible hotels in Chile. There's a group of hotels called the Tierra Hotels, and they're, like, super, you know, snazzy. And that was part of this package. So I suddenly have these four nights. My wife had been to Chile some years ago when she did, like, travelling as a student, and had been to Santiago very briefly before she went with her dad and did the Inca Trail.
Oh, right.
And while her dad was there, he got mugged and had all of his paperwork stolen. Passport, you know, money, the works. And this was, like, before the days where you could just, like, get on the internet and, you know, organise all that. So it really totally did them up a kipper. And therefore, my wife had no real interest in going back to Chile. And so I said I was going to go with my best mate. Now, my best mate is going through a bit of a rough time at the moment, and as a result, he can't. He couldn't at the time I won this thing. He couldn't commit to being that far away from England in case he had to get back to England. Chile's a 14-hour flight away, so it, you know, it's not round the corner. And not only is Chile a 14-hour flight away, but there's like a little plane that only runs once a day. That's a 1.5-hour flight to this little island where this hotel was on. So he just kept saying to me, mate, when things clear up a bit, maybe I'll be able to commit to it. So they extended the deadline for when we could go, and then they extended it again. But the second time they extended it, they said, look, that really is the last time we're going to extend it. And so it was that I said to my wife, you know, look, I don't think I'm going to be able to go. And she's like, what are you on about? You paid all that money. You bloody going, even if I've got to come with you.
Bloody enjoy it as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was, both of us then had to spend several more hundreds of pounds on the flights to go to Chile without either of us really being that bothered about going to Chile. Mm. Her, even sort of semi-actively, not really wanting to go very much at all, but, you know, spent all that money and whatever. So it was that we flew to Santiago, and then we flew... We flew to Santiago, and then we got a two-hour bus to the coast, to a place called Valparaiso. Then the next day, we got the bus back to Santiago, and then from there flew to this little island off the west coast of Chile called Chiloé. And, oh my God, we expected nothing, and it over-delivered like you cannot imagine. The street art culture in Chile is breathtaking, so every corner you turn is just like, you know, these amazing murals, all the architecture that's been put there over, you know, Santiago over, you know, years. Then everything is surrounded by mountains because it's basically the Andes. And the people were tremendous. We were in this little bit called the Bella Vista Patio, I think it was, which is like the safe tourist nightlife zone. All very policed because, you know, it can be a bit dicey there. At Valparaiso, we just walked around and had a rare old time of it. It was blooming tremendous. And that was before we got to this little island, Chiloé, which is fairly remote, not terribly developed. The hotel's one of those, like, sustainable things where they grow a lot of the food on the grounds. Everything's sourced from within, like, 10 miles or whatever. The food was incredible. Chilean red wine, I'm sure many of our listeners may be enjoying a glass of that, even as we speak. But I would say to anybody, Chile isn't necessarily one of those places that people bang on about, oh, God, you really must go. But we had an absolute ball. And weirdly, I spent a lot of it thinking about you, Kath.
Why?
Well, because they all speak Spanish.
Yeah.
And I thought this would be a different experience again if I could even speak, you know, anything outside of gracias.
Well, my friend, one of the school mums, comes from Chile, and we often talk about perhaps one day me going, because she's from Antofagasta, which is a sort of mining-type place. But I think it is quite near the sea.
Oh, and, yeah. Well, it's all relatively near the sea because it's just that strip down there,
yeah,
you know, on the coast between the Andes and there.
But she's talking about going back for a year, taking the kids while they can because they're both quite young, getting the kids speaking decent Spanish.
Yeah.
Because she's married to a Welshman.
So right.
So the kids' accent's a little bit... I mean, they've got all the right words, but
yeah,
it's a bit of an interesting... accent they've got. But she said, you know, they with a year they could crack it and it'll be an experience, and she's trying to convince her husband to let her go for a year.
Yeah, I'm all into that. I think, you know, the older you get, you realize that actually your life will be defined by the adventures that you undertake, and just plowing on with the same old on your, you know, as the last breath rattles from you, you're going to look back and think about all the things you didn't do, having forgotten many of the things that you did.
Yeah.
Also, I'm not entirely... I might be wrong about this, because it might not be Chile, but there is a South American town that only speaks Welsh.
Yes, you're right.
There was... When they were doing a lot of mining in South America, there was a call put out for miners, and a lot of Welsh people put their hand in the air and said, yeah, all right, we'll give that a go. All moved over there, only spoke Welsh, and the native population dwindled, but the mining population continued. So now there are all these incredible, you know, tanned South Americans that only speak Welsh.
It's Argentina.
It's Argentina.
Chubut, it's called. In the Chubut province of Patagonia, around 5,000 people speak Welsh.
Incredible.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Yeah, quite something. So, yeah, that was my take on chili. The other thing that I would say, Barry, and I think maybe this would chime somewhat with you, is that I just didn't know anything about the political situation in Chile. I absolutely don't understand that at all, because it was Pinochet, wasn't it, who... Was it? No, hang on, I've got that wrong.
No, that's Argentina. Hang on, no, I may be wrong.
Hang on. Yeah, we'll work that out, because Kath's Googling it.
No, you're right, Chile.
Yeah, it was Chilean dictator, General Augustus Pinochet.
And the Allende's, you remember Allende? You know, Isabel Allende's a writer. Her father was the president for a while as well.
Okay.
Yeah, but you're right, Pinochet.
Yeah. So I don't really know what their kind of recent social history is, or how they're set up as a country. It all, in the weird globalized world in which we live, it didn't particularly feel like, oh my God, we're in a whole different place here.
Yeah.
It just felt like you could be in Dusseldorf.
Whereas Cuba, I went to Cuba, and I would love to go once the dictatorship is over, if that ever happens.
You're
because
right.
Because I didn't see Cuba. You're kept very apart from the average Joe.
Yeah.
And the hotels we were staying in were also being used as government buildings. So there were whole areas of the hotel you couldn't go in. Those, like, Secret Service, not-so-Secret Service guys in the in the hallways and stuff. So you did get a real... I tried to buy a book in Spanish about Castro. They didn't have any.
Wow.
They certainly didn't have any in English either.
Good God.
In any of the bookshops in the place. And, you know, but I did go to the supermarkets or something else as well. Because you want beans? There's beans.
Right.
There's no brands.
Right.
It's like, you know, you buy things.
Yeah.
But they, obviously, because they don't import.
Yeah.
There's beans. There's, like, one brand of beer.
But do you really need more than that?
As long as they're decent beans. But what if they're the crappy beans that your mum used to get sometimes and think you wouldn't notice they were reduced sugar?
Stop trying to put a fast one, Mum, for God's sakes.
These ain't Heinz.
Bring this dictatorship down, because if this hasn't got a 52 on the can, I'm not interested.
The Great Bean Wars.
So, yeah, that was the actual dealing with everybody and the kind of general vibe there was really fun. And I would recommend people to go, but I don't know anything about how it's really set up as a country or what its recent social history is or what's changing there. It was just a fun time for me and the wife.
Good.
Have you been round that way, Barry?
No, I haven't, Rufus, but because I value your sort of open-minded views, but you've answered the question, it was leading me to ask you, you know, how you generally thought that the country was and what sort of reception you got. Now, my link with it, it brought back memories for me. It was in the 70s. I remember my two little ones, as they were then. We went on a demo with some Labour Party members, I was then living in a little mining community up in Staffordshire, and we went down. I had a sort of a mini coach, and there was a big demo in support of, Salvador Allende was actually brought down by the Pinochet regime. They stormed the presidential palace, and there's pictures of Salvador Allende in a helmet, fought to the last, you know, and sort of he was machine gun, and it was a terrible, terrible thing. I really felt the pain of the Chilean people. As I say, it was a big demo in the 70s, and that sort of rekindled my memories. I've always sort of had a soft spot with the Chilean people. I know things have improved a great deal. And that was really why I was asking you. But, yeah, you fully answered the questions. But your general opinion and was that you had a good time there and you found the people very nice.
Yeah, it felt very, you know, very Spanish outposty. It was cafes, you know, half-decent... Well, actually, I'd say there's half-decent coffee. They're only round the corner from Colombia. So you think, oh, wow, this coffee's going to be amazing. Didn't have a decent cup of coffee the entire time we were there. Because, you know, I think my palate's just attuned to coffee being something slightly more refined, whereas I think they take theirs pretty much straight out of the ground. So it was, not great coffee. But apart from that, I mean, I didn't drink a lot of coffee. I did drink quite a lot of red wine. And that was worth enjoying.
Yeah, it's just that I've always had that affinity with the Chilean people, you know. back to those days, there was a lot of things happened. Margaret Thatcher was invited over here. Pinochet. There was a lot of opposition to that, and a lot of demonstrations. As I say, it just sort of rekindled that memory of it.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Rufus? Anyway.
I'm good, Barry. I've just got too much work on, which is, when you're self-employed, is the problem that you want to have.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Equally. The sort of work that I've got, each job requires quite a lot of time and, like, concentration and focus. So when you end up with a lot of it on, you then immediately hate yourself because you think, oh, I should be using this time to do 12 other things. It's just the new and exciting way I've worked out of how to make myself unhappy about myself. And there would always be one, but it just happens that, you know, that is the one that I'm currently enjoying.
Yeah, I've got a lot of mates who were directly employed in local government, various, and lost the jobs, you know, went self-employed. And they say to me that there's this thing about you never want to turn anything down because you then might get that void and there's no work there. So it's understandable, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I was absolutely chocker up until December. And then January and February, I was like, Have I become unemployable and no one's told me? It was starting to get a bit tight, you know. Because I had a reasonable year last year. There was money in the bank to, like, oh, the mortgage is covered, you know. We got, because you try and do that, don't you? Divide it up, like, make sure you got your money put aside for tax and the, you know, oh, this will see us through, so we can't spend that.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But when that account starts going down and there's not really much topping it back up again. Do start to feel the old bumhole tighten slightly. These Kegels may come in more useful than they might otherwise do, were I employed by another.
Yeah, I guess the thing is with Catherine and yourself, you know, with a young family, that's always a good balance. You know, you've always got to keep a little bit of time.
Yeah, well, that is the joy of having that time, is you think, oh, well, this is great. I can walk the kids to school and pick them up and do their homework with them,
yeah.
And sort of remind them that I exist. But, you know, that we've seen put an end to that.
They're over it.
Yeah. Yeah, just, like, you know, check back in. It's a weird one. I think as a parent, especially in the modern age, I think parents of years gone by, it was like, well, you have kids, get on with it, kids. You know, you're alive. That's, you know, we'll put a roof over your head and food on the table, but get on with it. But modern parenting is all about, you know, well, what are you doing psychologically to your child? Are you really there for them? Are you, you know, decent enough and kind enough and patient enough? And essentially, all of those questions just mean that you will always feel on some level that you're failing.
Yeah, you're either involved, you're not involved enough, you're too involved.
Too involved. Helicoptered.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, there's just, you know, so, you know, I'm kind of weirdly aware that a woman that I worked with who I really liked a great deal and continue to like a great deal, not necessarily past tense, but her dad was an actor. She was like, just give it up, Rufus. Don't do this. Don't do it to your kids. Your kids never know where they are with you. You're always off here, there and everywhere. You're either around too much and then panicking that you're not working, or you're working and we never see you. Just give it up. Do something else.
Well, newsflash. Other jobs take you away from your kids too.
Well, that's, and then, you know, that's the argument that you end up having with your other half
and
when you are away.
And don't feed your soul half as much.
Well, don't feed your soul, but also, There's another more immediate practical consideration, which is, if I don't do this, it's not like there's 12 jobs at the bank going and I could take one of those, but I'm choosing not to.
Yeah.
I have no transferable skills. I either do some version of showing off or starve to death.
Yeah, no one wants to see that.
No one wants to see that. It's like, I always remember the kind of cruelty of those pictures taken from of Jeffrey at Rainbow working in the supermarket. It's like, yeah, he just got to a new phase of his life where this is, the you know, his reality. And I think having that hovering over you where you feel like, unless you're always showing off, unless people know who you are, you've failed. As opposed to, yeah, you know, it's show business. It's meant to come and go. You're meant to shine brightly and disappear.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That
and
notional
also,
failure.
But also, there are people that work in supermarkets and they're not failures. Why is it any different because once you were Jeffrey from Rainbow?
Yeah. Yeah, well,
probably for a period of about 5 years, which is a drop in the ocean when it comes to someone's life.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe he was making a career out of it, or maybe he had enough money to tide him over, but wanted to get out of the house and meet people and, you know, contribute something. We don't know, but what I do know is that working in a supermarket has definitely been used more than once in my lifetime as shorthand for, oh, yeah, you know, works in a supermarket. Like, right? Or, like, works in McDonald's, it's a muck job.
Yeah.
You know, we do have this somewhat bizarre attitude towards, you know, unless you're... If you don't do office work, oh, right, yeah, it's all gone wrong. Or, you know, unless you're self-employed and earning millions, well, you know, it didn't really pan out. So we've got, you know, that classic British class snobbery about what you do and how you keep a roof over your head that never really asks any questions below the surface of the kind of lazy insult.
No, you're right.
So, yeah, that's how I am, Barry.
It's interesting to hear from, you know, the sort of acting perspective. There's a young gentleman, as he was then, young guy, and he'd been with Sylvia Young. Have you heard of them, Sylvia Young?
Yeah, no, they're very well.
He went down as a sort of his child actor. He went to London about 11, so, you know, there's myself, you know, with a background in hard physical work, and then later moving down to Western Supermare and finding a job that was, you know, much easier and all the rest of it. Anyway, I finished up at the conference centre. And Robbie, he came, I think, at about 16 or 17, moved away a little bit from acting, still had that determination to want to do it, and he was killing some time before he went to Bristol Old Vic and he got his degree.
Oh, wow.
So we worked with him for a while, and, you know, the thing I like about life is, you know, you learn so much from other people, totally, totally different sort of experience, life experience than myself, but what a lovely guy. But he had no understanding of workplaces. I sort of took him under my wing, you know. We've become very, very good friends, and I'm godfather to one of his children. Mm-hmm. But, he got his degree. He was picking up a few parts here and there as an adult actor. Did some pantomime. I met a lady, fell in love, and walked away from it. And he's retrained now, and he's a school teacher. But I learned so much about, you know, I used to sort of joke a bit about the old thespians and all the rest, a little bit of banter. It was all good-natured. I mean, yeah. I love the bloke to bits. But, yeah, I learned so much about that side and, you know, the determination. And he also had parents who were very, very supportive, and he said he don't think that he would have been able to do what he did if it hadn't been for them.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things, isn't it? It's the reason that there are so many posh boy actors is it's such a hard thing to get into and to be able to stick at it and keep yourself free, ready for the parts when they come in. Unless you've got somebody bunging you a few quid every now and again, actually trying to sustain yourself is nigh on impossible.
And also, it's still the case where you've got to be in London, haven't you, really, to start out with. Be handy, be on the spot.
I think, yeah, I think on the whole that is true. But there are, you know, in big cities, there are kind of theatre movements. It's just, as ever, with all things in the arts,
yeah.
For that first bit, you've got to be prepared to work for absolutely nothing, live hand to mouth, in the hope that eventually at some point it all pays off, you know. The same with stand-up. Stand-up you do for, you know, no money. And, you know, the first 5 years I did stand-up, I think I earned about, all told, about 600 quid.
Right.
And then it got better.
Yeah.
Well, fresh out to you, Rufus. You're doing all right now, mate, and I'm pleased for you. I'm not going to take much more of your time up, Rufus. It's been lovely talking to you. I just want to finish by saying I have about 50 years membership in the Labour Party, and I've never once had a conversation with a rank-and-file member where there's been any sort of anti-Semitic rhetoric. So I don't know all the ins and outs of it, other than I don't think that Jeremy Corbyn's got a racist bone in his body. So that's just my experience. I speak with truth. So
Barry, you've ripped the lid off the can, and now you're just going to walk away. We've got to take a break, But I really would love to talk about this some more. We haven't got any other callers at the moment, so if you want to talk about this, 0344 499 1000. But Barry, do you mind staying on the line just while we take these ads, and we'll come back and we'll just talk about that very briefly if we
No, may. I'm happy to do that, Rufus.
All right,
thank you.
Around then. We'll be back with Barry after this.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Well, friends, it may come as little surprise to you that there's an actor and general show-off. You know, I'm fairly lefty. If you've listened to this show before, we've made no secret of that. And I have heard much of the output from this radio station and realised that maybe that makes me something of a rarity. A bird of paradise amidst the parrots of talk radio. But yes, a card-carrying member of the Labour Party who only joined the Labour Party once Jeremy Corbyn had taken leadership of it. I didn't really see the point before. You know, I got that there was a Labour Party, but from the age of 18, that was led by Tony Blair, that was largely offering a kind of, you know, diet version of conservatism. And then all elections fought since basically said, we'll do what the Tories would do, but we'll do it in a slightly nicer way. And so it didn't seem to me to be, you know, any kind of genuine alternative worth voting for. Then up pops Jeremy Corbyn. And everything he was saying seemed to be basically right, from what I could work out, in terms of what we need to do to change our society. For as long as we continue to operate in the way that we're operating, it feels to me that the money all bubbles up to the top. It's kept by, you know, very rich people, and it doesn't really dribble back down. And so the people at the bottom are essentially paying for the extravagances and the luxuries for the people at the top. And that's not really sustainable, especially when we've had the age of austerity, where libraries have closed and schools have closed and hospitals have closed and, you know, we're all aware of what's going on with the NHS and all of that. So, yeah, you know, spoke at some rallies and, you know, banged the drum for Jeremy Corbyn. So this whole anti-Semitism thing is rather troubling. Barry, before we took the break, said that in his experience as a card-carrying Labour member for many years, has never seen so much as a sniff of anti-Semitism, and I can well believe that's true, Barry.
No, I haven't, Rufus, and you know I'm not a London boy. Most of my life growing up was in Staffordshire, mining communities, and then down into Weston-super-Mare. And so I've gone from the north to the south, but no, never have I come across it at all. And, you know, it troubles me because I feel that the anti-Jeremy Corbyn agenda now is in full flow again. Mm. And like you, I'm disturbed about this because I think, you know, we do have a chance of putting things right in this country. We do have a chance of getting some rights back for workers and getting a bit of fairness. And from the first time I spoke to you about the young generation, you know, this not having to have three jobs to make the wage of one and sitting by your mobile phone or whatever it is they use to get a text to say that you're not needed today, all the rest of this stuff and the terrible brutalization of the NHS and all of these things that I'm passionate to change before I finally call it a day in this life. And so this troubles me. I can't add a great deal to it other than I've not come across it. I mean, I understand the complex issues and questions behind the state of Israel and displacement of the Palestinians and all of the rest. I'm not an expert in it, but the actual anti-Semitism, it's just something I've not come across.
Yeah. So here's the weird, the kind of coincidental thing that happened to me. I told you I'm working on this play, right? So I'm working with the phenomenal Tracy Ann Oberman. A finer actor you would struggle to meet, right? Brilliant. a socialist has, you know, as a young woman was on marches for socialism, you know, at a time when it wasn't on the increase, far from it. And she said to me that as a Jewish person, she found herself completely unable to support the current administration within the Labour Party. And she said this to me last week. And I started to argue with her about it and realised I knew absolutely nothing about what I was talking about. And I put a thing out on Twitter saying, I want to have this conversation with my work colleague, but I realise I don't know anything. Could anybody point me at some articles that would be helpful for me to be able to more readily understand it? And if I may, Barry, I would like to offer you the little that I have learned in the last week. And it's basically this. Whether or not we believe there is anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, what cannot be denied is that a vast number of Jewish people feel strongly that there is. Right?
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, whether it is there or it isn't there, we have to take that seriously.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And you know, it's got to be opened up. And, you know, there's no place for it in the Labour Party. The Labour Party isn't about racism of any kind. If you examine our history, you'll see that's the very thing that we stood up and fought for. A lot of people, when they came over, a lot of the West Indian people that came over, you know, in the first intake, you know, always there was a strong Labour vote because they knew that there was justice and there was care for their situation. And so we attracted a tremendous amount of that vote. And if there is something as far as any of our Jewish brothers and sisters are concerned, then yes, certainly let's bring it out. But my gut instinct is I just cannot see Jeremy Corbyn being the sort of guy that would harbour those sort of views.
No. So, cards on the table, neither can I. And you can watch videos on YouTube of him standing on Cabal Street. I think it's Cabal Street. Talking about his mother being part of the demonstrations in the East End, you know, defending Jewish people. And that the way that that oratory is given does not strike me as a man who is trying to pull a fast one or anything else. What is true about Jeremy Corbyn is that he has believed in and supported causes that people who do have anti-Semitic views have also supported. He has shared a platform with those people, therefore it does open him up to criticism that, you know, it isn't a concern or it isn't a thing he is concerned about. What I think is, personally, what I think is true about him is he's also the man, many years ago, said, let's talk to the IRA, and is accused of, you know, being a terrorist and wanting terrorism. Whereas, actually, it just seems to me that that guy's MO is really find people with whom you disagree, find people who, you know, don't have the most savoury way of going about things, but where you have things in common, use that thing in common to bring people to your table to get them to drop some of their more extreme feelings and actually concentrate on delivering, you know, a better outcome for everyone. However, it has undoubtedly left him wholly open to these charges and these allegations. But here's the thing, right? Outside of Jeremy Corbyn as a figurehead for this, I think that this idea that there's more anti-Semitism on the left than there is on the right just doesn't strike me as possibly being true. But what is true is that the left is meant to hold itself to a higher standard than we would expect of the right. If our politics is the politics of equality and everyone gets a fair crack of the whip and there is no better than you, then we can't also encourage any attitude that says because you were born here or your parents were, you know, this colour, or because you went to that place of worship, you are different or lesser. We can't espouse the politics of equality and then accept any system where that equality is challenged or people are made to feel lesser. So here's the other part of this that it seems to me that is a trap I personally have fallen into and absolutely is going to be the thing moving forward now that I want to be part of putting right. What I believe is that money doesn't trickle down, money trickles up. The idea of capitalism is essentially sold to us as, if you give people the opportunity to earn as much money as possible, then that's better for us all. Whereas we now live in a society where we see all of that money is at the top, very little of it's being put back in. It isn't trickling down. It isn't better for us all. It's just better for the people at the very top. What that then gives rise to is a belief that the real power currently is in the hands of big corporations and big banks. The link and the anti-Semitic link that has been forged is that, and you know who's in charge of those banks, don't you? You know who's in charge of those corporations, don't you? You know who the lawyers are that represent all those people, don't you? And the answer to those questions is, yes, it's the Jews. Cue lightning sound effect, cue anti-Semitic cartoons from the 1930s. Without realising it, there is an overlap between the way in which many on the left feel the world is going and what is wrong with the world in terms of how the money's moved around, and old-fashioned, very old-fashioned, anti-Semitic ideas. Now, it may well be that you want to fight for more equality, a better spread of wealth, income parity and all of those things, but to that cause will also be drawn anti-Semites. And when those arguments are espoused about why wealth should be shared out more equally, there are anti-Semitic ideas that can be snuck into that, which we are subliminally, almost, you know, unknowingly, foolishly, ill-educatedly able to adopt. And suddenly, people who I really respect, who I don't believe are racist and I don't think are anti-Semites, find themselves having arguments that have been put forward by anti-Semites with a background of anti-Semitism that we're not really aware of. And the biggest one is this. If you get into a conversation about how Jewish people feel about the racism they perceive and feel and can point at and prove is happening to them day after day after day, how soon is it before somebody who feels attacked, but I'm not a racist, I'm not an anti-Semite. You can't just call everyone an anti-Semite who has a problem with Israel. Look at the Palestinians, right? That argument is used as a wiper to just scrap aside how you feel, scrap aside that you, as this, you know, proud Jewish person, feel your life is being genuinely made worse by the endorsement of ideas that essentially claim you to be lesser and worth nothing. Well, never mind how you feel about that. Scrap that, because the country that somehow you're represented by, or you secretly, you know, empower or secretly have a plan for, it's all part of your little secret cabal, your little conspiracy. Yeah, look at what they're doing in Palestine. So never mind what you feel about what's going on right here, right now, in your country that you were born and bred in. Never mind that. What about Israel? And it is just used as a way of eroding their personhood. It doesn't matter whether you have experienced anti-Semitism or witnessed it. It is absolutely crystal clear that Jewish people are hugely troubled by the fact that there are many on the left who put aside, who diminish their own reality, their own truth and their own feelings about how they are treated by those in the Labour Party or those on the left, and they are having that taken away from them. Now, I don't believe that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite, but until the Labour Party absolutely introduces a zero tolerance to anybody espousing overtly, genuinely, deliberately anti-Semitic ideas, and just says you have no place here, gone, out of the door, firstly. Secondly, leads the way on explaining why some of these things that, in inverted commas, aren't anti-Semitic are actually anti-Semitic. You know, that is part of the education of people to realise why Jewish people feel the way they do about this. That's the leadership that's required. That is what is needed. Because until you are actually part of the solution, you will always be accused of being part of the problem. Jewish people are saying they are facing racism, growing racism, day after day after day. We cannot ignore that. We cannot dismiss it. We cannot point at the actions of a nation state elsewhere and say, well, never mind how you feel, justify that first. No, bloody deal with this. Deal with this now. Because there is so many ways in which, if you're not Jewish, you don't pick up on the subtle anti-Semitism that is going on all the time. That mural, I would absolutely happily, with my hand on my heart, say, I would look at that, I didn't think it was anti-Semitic. I had no idea that it had any relationship with that at all. To me, that was about rich white men sat around a table with, you know, the people cowed on their backs, you know, and while they're all doing very well. Men in suits versus the underclass holding everything up. But my God, once you realise it was absolutely created deliberately as an anti-Semitic statement, you can't look at it and think for a moment, my God, of course that's what it is. Of course it is. But we need to understand that. We need to be better educated. We need to be more sensitive to those things that are hurting our Jewish brothers and sisters. So I don't personally believe that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite. I don't personally believe that the Labour Party and the left of the Labour Party has anti-Semitic intentions, which it is keeping secret, or you know, has some other game plan that, you know, involves being beastly to Jewish people. But until we take people, Jewish people's feelings seriously, deal with them, and are part of the solution in stamping out the thing that is making their life awful, how can we assure them that that isn't the case? We can't just point at a different argument and pretend that their feelings don't exist. They do, and they deserve to be taken seriously. It is racism by any other name. So I don't think for one moment that, you know, you would have witnessed anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. But it's there are ideas at play here that are anti-Semitic. And we need to address them, and we need to explain why they need addressing, and we need to explain why we're going to stamp them out.
Yeah, I agree with it. I think you've put that together very, very well indeed, Rufus. And I can only come back to what I said. I've never heard it, and I consider myself to be just an ordinary sort of guy, tried to do his best, tried to have some values, tried to have some opinions that I feel are creditable. And I know that there's, with all of the people that I come across, we have this affinity with Jewish people because of what happened with the Holocaust, you know? Mm. And I think Labour people would be the first ones to stand up and to fight against anything that was of a nature that wasn't acceptable to us.
Mm.
And I think the point that you made, Jeremy Corbyn, during the long years of backbencher, where he was fighting for a lot of socialist beliefs, always was about getting people together, was always about getting dialogue. And I think, you know, this is how this will be dealt with. It's there, it should be brought out into the open. We should look at everything. We should, as you said, not have to accept labels being put on us if we're questioning something by any government, whether it's Israeli or otherwise, that's to do with political abuse or bad treatment of people or whatever. And I'm thinking what's happening in Spain now. There are certain things there. So wherever it is, yeah, it's got to be opened up.
Mm.
But I'll finish with what I said originally. I can honestly, and on my heart, say that I've never, ever come across it in any shape or form. And I've lived 75 years now. And a lot of that has been within the Labour Party family. So I would hope that that would count for something, Rufus.
No, I would honestly say, I think the vast, vast majority of Labour Party members would have no truck with any of these ideas. The problem is that there are some who do, and in the same way that you've just said that, you know, they would be the first to stand up and stamp it out, let's be the first to stand up and stamp it out. We'll be back after these commercial messages.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Hey, look, we just wanged on so long that we're almost at the end of the show. But before then, Julian's phoned in, so it'd be rude not to speak to him. But I warn you in advance, Julian, that we're going to be off air in about 5 minutes, so we have to make this quick.
No problem, Rufus. We'll make it quick. I'm just wondering, what exactly is anti-Semitic about the mural? And I believe the three figures in the middle depicted the Rothschilds, which is a Jewish family, the Rockefellers, which is a Christian family, if you like, and I think Morgan, which is another Christian family. So how is it anti-Semitic and not anti-Christian? Is it not just anti the less than 1%?
Yeah, okay. I will... hang on, give me a second.
I know you don't have long to come back on that.
No. I'll tell you the quickest... Oh, hang on a second. See, I'm just going to pull something up that I think really
nails it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And it'll just take me 1 minute to find...
Because on the face of it, I thought, exactly as you said, it doesn't look explicit. I know there is a Jewish stereotype about bankers, etc., and it can be an anti-Semitic canard.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, look, I think
facts
it is...
Facts, aren't they?
So the article that I was reading was in the Jewish Chronicle, and the thing that slightly, like, panged at me somewhat was the article in Jewish Chronicle says there is no way anybody could look at this and not say it was anti-Semitic. But I could well believe in looking at it, that it didn't have the signal, it didn't have like the kind of neon light behind it saying this is anti-Semitic. My sensitivity to that is set so low that I kind of require that for me to see it as an anti-Semitic image. Again, it's one of the things that I realise I need to change about myself, is to be able to see those things a little more clearly for what they really are. But I'm trying to find it.
I've got something from the Jewish Voice here, if you like.
Okay.
The Jewish Voice. The Daily Mail going after Corbyn is a tough choice for us. Do we pick the newspaper who backed the Nazis or the guy who would have been with us on the barricades with us fighting the fascists at Cable Street? I think we'll stick with Mr. Corbyn. That's from the Jewish Voice.
Yeah, look. Again.
Well, of course, Corbyn came out and said
it
was anti-Semitic. I'm just wondering, can anyone tell me exactly how?
Yeah. Well, the thing I'm trying to find, and I'm failing to, and now, you know, we're running out of time.
You on tomorrow night?
Is that the artist, I think I probably am. But the artist himself said, yes, it's an image that was specifically created to underline that, you know, these Jewish people are in control of it. And if I could find the actual quote, this would be a lot more useful.
Yeah, he talks about the danger of the New World Order, doesn't he?
Danger of the New World Order, and says, you know, that it is specifically created to underline that. So, you know, I think, frankly, you can argue the detail of it, of like, but what's anti-Semitic about this? A, the artist said it had been created in that spirit.
I thought he said it was about privilege. And he didn't mention Jews. I mean,
Julian, I would love to be able to pull up the actual quote from the artist himself.
Maybe we'll
come back to this tomorrow night. To be honest, it's one of those things where I'm happy to discuss it. It's a late night alternative. That's very much how this works. But on the other hand, what we are now going to get for the next at least week is political capital being made out of this. And as much as possible, just contributing to the noise. You tune into Talk Radio tomorrow. That's all you're going to hear from breakfast till dinner time. And if I can avoid talking about this stuff, I will. But I think the point that needs making is
where we've got Jewish people who are saying they are experiencing racism and this it feels incredibly real to them, we should listen to them in the way that we would listen to any group. If it was black people saying, there's, you know, we're being pinned up against walls and spat in our faces, we wouldn't then ask them to justify what was racist about the thing that they, you know, that had upset them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. I think many of us guilty of not realizing that there are some very subtle flavors of anti-Semitism in some of the arguments that I think many of us have adopted without really realizing where that crossover occurs. And it's not good enough anymore to say, you don't get to choose, Jewish people, what is racist and what isn't. I think you've got to say, it feels racist to you, well, let's stamp that out because we are anti-racism. Anyway, Julian, I apologise. No, mate, I do take your point, and if I could find the quote, that would have been slightly better. I believe Kath and I will be back with you later on today.
Yeah, you bet ya.
Yeah, you bet your bottom dollar. In the meantime, there will be some commercial messages, and there will also be the ever handsome, ever wise, ever ready Paul Ross. Until then, be well.